Head On with Bob Kincaid. Head On is brought to you every night by the West Virginia District Council of Carpenters and Millwrights. Union Carpenters and Millwrights. They're building the American dream. Free speech isn't free if you don't use it. So call Bob now at 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Now, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Hey, good evening. I'm Bob Kincaid. And it is one of those come-up-screaming kind of days. You know what's fun? Let me tell you what's fun. What's fun is running a network and being an IT guy when you're not an IT guy. I've been in internet hell all day long. And I'll be quite honest with you, I have not had adequate time to do the show prep that I like to do on any given evening. Now, I'm getting a dirty look from Agnes, and I don't know why. But the fact that, you know, we'll get through. I think we can pull off 3 hours of high-quality radio this evening, especially in light of the fact that it is Wednesday, and you know what Wednesday means. It's prayer meeting night. Every Wednesday is prayer meeting night here at Head On. So, you know, we've got that going for us. And also coming up, here in about 7.5 minutes, as far as I can tell. Yeah, you know how it is with me and math. But in about 7.5 minutes, we're going to be joined by author Jeff Biggers, author of The United States of Appalachia, subtitled How Southern Mountaineers Brought Independence, Culture, and Enlightenment to America. And he details and fleshes out his thesis very well in the book. There's a link to the book over at whiterosesociety.org/kincaid.html. You know, the same page you go to get the links to the live stream and the archives. You can click on it. It'll take you right to the purchase point for the book. I highly recommend it, especially for anyone, A, with a Southern background, or B, a passion for understanding a lot of American history that just sort of gets glossed over. It is an absolutely fascinating, enjoyable read. So, you know, run on by if you've got a few extra nickels. You will enjoy it immensely. Because there's nothing dry about it. For those people who go, I don't like history. I don't think there's anybody that listens to this program that would say, I don't like history, because we understand that history is, what's past is prologue, is what Shakespeare said. But, so we've got that interview coming, and we will have an excellent time of it, I do believe. Frankly, if you want to ask Mr. Biggers some questions, you can do that as well. That's just how high tech we are. We can bring you on, and you can ask any question concerning the topic and the tome that you wish. But so that's where the immediate front end of the program is going. On the other hand, I saw this one early in the morning before my life in internet hell began. And the first thing that came to mind was maybe it's time to just turn around, go home, buy the Twinkies, watch the TV, drink Jack Daniels through a straw, you know, whatever it is you do to forget the fight that we've got going on that we're trying to wage. So every now and then, like the National Geographic Society will issue the results of a study showing that American school children think that Afghanistan is just south of Philly, you know, that kind of thing. Well, we got another one of those today. This one, Dateline Chicago, Americans apparently know more about the Simpsons than they do about the First Amendment. And this is one of those real bone-chilling kind of studies. This is that you read about this and you suddenly understand why it is that people like George Bush can get into office. It's ignorance based. Only one. You've probably already seen this, but it bears reiteration. Only one in four Americans can name more than one of the five freedoms guaranteed by the First Amendment. Next question, how many can you name? Honestly. I mean, I'm a First Amendment kind of guy, and I had to sit and scratch my head over the last one. There's five. There's five whole freedoms in the First Amendment. And most Americans can name Homer and Marge and Bart and Maggie and Lisa. Homer, Marge, Bart, Maggie. Yeah, that's the five Simpsons. They can name the five Simpsons, but they can't name the five freedoms. I can even name the guy at the Quickie Mart. Apu Nahasapina Petawan. Can you? No. It's a depressing study. Honest to God, it is. I mean, these are the... Look, you know if you listen to this program with any regularity at all that I'm a cartoon junkie. I mean, I was weaned on Bugs Bunny and have not gotten over it to this day. If I had my way, every other phrase would be followed by a soundbite from some Bugs Bunny cartoon. The first thing that I thought of when Deadeye Dick Cheney shot Harry Whittington was Bugs Bunny singing, "You're gonna hurt someone with that old shotgun. Hey, what's up, Doc?" So I'm in touch with that segment of America that likes their cartoons. I mean, I even like Aqua Teen Hunger Force. So you know that tells you I'm still plugged in. But not to the exclusion of my heritage, not to the exclusion of my history, not to the exclusion of my civic duties to my country. Do you want to take a guess at the five freedoms contained in the First Amendment? And no internet cheating. Now just stop it. Let's find out if we're any better than Joe and Jane Sixpack, sitting there on the couch drinking their Duff beer. See, I even know the beer Homer drinks. Let's find out tonight, just along the way, you know, and again, it's not going to be any fun if you cheat. Cheaters never win and winners never cheat. Well, 2000 and 2004 kind of put the lie to that one, didn't they? But yeah, the story is depressing as hell. The study by the new McCormick Tribune Freedom Museum found that 22% of Americans could name all five Simpson family members, compared with just 1 in 1,000. That's 0.1%, sports fans. 0.1%, 1 in 1,000 people who could name all five First Amendment freedoms. Now, Joe Madera said he was surprised. He runs the museum. Part of the survey really shows there are misconceptions, and part of our mission is to clear up these misconceptions. Now, what's disturbing to me is you could ask, some weirdo religious fundy. You could ask them what the five freedoms were in the First Amendment, and you know what? You would lickety-split get freedom of religion. And then they would follow up by telling you, and by the way, did you know that there ain't no such thing in that First Amendment as a separation of church and state? You would. I mean, that's... But they couldn't tell you any of the other four. Now, is guns in it? Is that where we get the rights to keep and arm bears? And God knows if you ask them about, the Fourth Amendment. Huh? There's four? I thought it was just religion we was free for. And guns and religion. That's all you really need, God and guns.
Ain't there an amendment in there that says there ain't supposed to be no gays?
That's what we're dealing with. So it's not inspiring. Because the story I've got coming from the Associated Press notes that people misidentified First Amendment rights. 1 in 5 people thought, oh, God, just shoot me. 1 in 5 people thought the right to own a pet was protected. That's okay. That's okay, Agnes. 38% thought that the right against self-incrimination was in the fit. That's in Amendment 5. There's 5 of them? Yeah, that's in Amendment 5. They thought that was in the First Amendment. God almighty. The survey was of 1,000 people. They called 1,000 people. And of the 1,000 people they called, only one got it right. What kind of people were in that group of 1,000? I mean, this is a random survey. There's going to be truckers and cops and teachers and firemen and computer technicians and guys that work at the Quickie Mart and brewery workers and stay-at-home moms and grannies and granddads, and one got it right. That should tell you a boatload about America. It tells you everything you need to know about November 2000. It tells you everything you need to know about November 2004. Newsflash, it tells you everything you need to know about November 2006 and November 2008 and November 2010 and November 2012. Ad infinitum, unless something changes big time in this country. Everything you need to know is contained in that report. That is the America that doesn't, that's the America that doesn't care what happens next. That's the America that doesn't care if their jobs get outsourced. Hold on one moment. That is an America that you need, that we need to be direly and desperately concerned with. And this segues very nicely into our next call here. Mr. Jeff Biggers is on the line, author of The United States of Appalachia, How Southern Mountaineers Brought Independence, Culture, and Enlightenment to America. Are you with us there, Jeff?
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show, Bob.
Oh, thank you so much for joining us. We really, really do appreciate it. Let me just start out by saying, I've been running my yap about this book for a week and a half now. I haven't been moved or amazed or just thrilled with reading any kind of historical work in quite a long time. You really struck a chord with me.
Oh, that's great. I'm just thrilled to hear it. It's a real labor of love. So to hear that from you, especially where you're coming from, is great.
Well, let me ask you. I read, the obligatory book jacket information, Jeff.
Right.
It says you've worked as a writer, radio correspondent all around the U.S., Europe, India, Mexico. What brought you back to Appalachia?
You know, I've been with Appalachia since 1983. I'm originally from southern Illinois, the hill country down there. I think a lot of people think of Illinois as being a place of, either Chicago, corn, or Al Capone, but we actually have a very unusual hill culture in the coal fields down in southern Illinois on the border of Kentucky. And that's the heritage I came out of. In 1983, I was a college dropout and was for various reasons, had left school and was going through the mountain south working on farms during the day and trying to do a little walking and essentially get my head straight. And I was picked up by someone. And for some odd reason, I did the stupid thing of making a joke about hillbillies. And the driver stopped and told me to get out. And I said, no, I come from a hillbilly culture. And he said, what do you even know about hillbillies? And I realized I knew nothing. And so in 1983, he gave me two options. He said, you can either get out of the car or you can come in with me and learn about mountain culture and mountain heritage. And then he took me into Pipestem, West Virginia, at the Appalachian South Folklife Center, mm-hmm. where I met Don West, who, of course, was a legendary poet and activist and educator. And it really began a 23-year love affair I've had with Appalachia, that even working abroad and working in other states and other countries, Appalachia never really left me. I continue to go back and visit it and stay there, and it's really a big part of my heart is there.
Well, I'm a much more enlightened human being, and you know, I live here for having read your book, Jeff. Let's talk about a few of the people that are in the book that perhaps folks did. I didn't get it, you know, and I've gone through college and postgraduate, and some of these people I never heard of, and I'm so glad to know about them. I feel like somehow there's a gap in my heritage that's been filled in with all this. Let's talk a little bit about Washington District, if you would, please.
Sure. You know, when we think of the vanguard of the American Revolution, of course, we think of Thomas Jefferson and the Continental Congress, and that everything happened in Philadelphia, of course, the Boston Tea Party. And what the historians have never really come to grips with is that the first community to defy the British, you know, not the first free independent community, because, of course, we had squatter settlements throughout the mountains, but the first community to organize themselves, have their own articles of association, their own elected courts and judges, and their own deeds, who raised their own militia and dealt with other foreign countries and indigenous people as a sovereign nation. You know, the first community in America to say no to the British in terms of the Declaration of Independence was years before Thomas Jefferson. It was in 1772 in what is today the eastern Tennessee Mountains outside of Johnson City in Elizabethton. And it was this group that called themselves the District of Washington. And basically what they had done was create this community within Cherokee Territory that eventually turned into an unusually democratic community. Now, what's important is most historians look at this community in 1772 as just a bunch of outlaws and squatters.
People. Renegades.
Renegades, you know, sort of the riffraff and the rugrats of American society. And it couldn't have been anything more to the contrary. In fact, the British governor to Virginia wrote a letter, and he said, "This is the dangerous example to America. And if the other colonies find out about it, this is the end of the empire." And so it truly did set an example of people who are willing to take that risk, like most mountaineers, and go that extra step toward freedom and independence.
Well, you know, if you go through public schools here in West Virginia, somewhere along the way you're taught in your West Virginia history class that the Revolution actually began in what is now West Virginia at Point Pleasant, or what is it, Tuendy Way? And in fact, that was some of those Washington District mountaineers marching to that battle, was it not?
Right. You know, we declared it Dunmore's War because Lord Dunmore was the one who had essentially got the prestige and acclaim for it. But essentially, the people, as always, who were on the front line were the common people, and it was the people who were living in the backwoods who had already raised their militias. And so when they finally decided that they needed to take on the Shawnee, who were leading all sorts of attacks in the central Appalachians along the Ohio River Valley. And, of course, strategically, this was very important because there was all sorts of alliance between the French and their Indian alliances, and of course the British and their alliances, and then the American settlers. And so you had these folks from the back country, and not only in the District of Washington, but throughout areas in today's contemporary of West Virginia, who aligned themselves and put themselves on the front line to begin that war, which, yeah, often we do consider as sort of the first shot in the American Revolution, because it's there that the Americans and the American colonists realized that they could have the destiny of their future, their country, in their own hands, that they could defeat, you know, the Shawnee and the other alliances that had to land there.
But, of course, your book goes much further afield than that story alone, although that one took my breath away. Again, it just shone a light on my ignorance. You cover... not just that, you cover musical heritage, you cover a literary heritage. I sort of lost my mind one night a week or so ago talking about Anne Royal. She's as far as I can tell. Now, you never quite got around to saying it this way, and I can understand why. But the light that you shine shows that nothing's changed that much. I read about her, and suddenly I realized I was dealing with the first blogger.
Right. Exactly. You know, that's a great point, Bob. You know, I call her the America's first muckraker. But what is a blogger but a great muckraker, you know?
Yeah, and she had to go, just like especially on the liberal side of things, and that's what we deal with here, Jeff, the liberal and progressive side of things, we have to go around with our hands out and say, you know, can I have a donation? Can you spare me a buck here? Can you spare me a buck there? And that seems to be the way that the left blogosphere operates, and that's exactly what she was dealing with.
Right, and here's a woman who operating nearly 200 years ago, you know, who goes to Washington, literally a woman who was raised in the backwoods. And, of course, marries a plantation owner and not only devours his fortune but also devours his library and his thinking and his free thinking. And as a woman who very much was autodidactic and self-educated, who launched herself onto the American scene as someone who is willing to criticize the elite and take on sort of the tyranny of corruption and the elite that was in Washington. And of course, she was really a spur in everyone's behind because she would essentially look for every element of graft and corruption. And
well, her willingness to go after the religious chicanery and the charlatans of her day, I find absolutely amazing.
Right. And inspiring because, you know, she said, you know, this is after the Great Awakening. You know,
right.
We had the first revivals in the backwoods of Kentucky in 1801. And sort of course, we had this Protestant revival of the emotional branch of our Protestantism, which also was very much a part of the revival in the Presbyterian Church, too. And she took them all on. She said, and what's very haunting to me is that her language often is a language we could look at today, that how dare we allow religious elements to take over our state? You know, that even then there was an incredible movement to influence the presidency, to side with the side of certain Protestant movements, to have a lack of separation between church and state. And I feel often when we look at the Mountain South or people in the South, you know, especially the folks from the North, sort of in a very snooty way say, you know, look at those people. They've been completely overrun by the religious right. And we don't realize that there are these incredible thinkers and pockets of resistance, people who actually emerge out of this and who actually call an ace for an ace and say, this is not how America was based and this is not the great American legacy that I'm part of.
And that's so true, Jeff, because one of the things we've talked about on this program is the fact that, you know, shortly after the 2004 election, we were immediately shown these maps that were just blood red throughout the South and made it seem as though there was not a progressive or liberal or free thinking individual anywhere south of the Mason-Dixon line.
Exactly.
And in fact, it is that culture that has produced, you know, not just the Ann Royals, Helen Keller.
Right, exactly.
They put Helen Keller on the back of the commemorative quarter for the state of Alabama, and yet if you told most Alabamians that she was not a shrinking violet socialist, but a real live out there in your face socialist, that she never would have made it onto the money.
Right. I think you're making a good point, Bob, because the other night I was speaking down in eastern Tennessee, and a young man stood up and he said, "This is great history about the progressive South, but who are the progressives today?" And I think he sort of was raising the question that he felt outnumbered. And I felt like what I wanted to show in my book was for 200 years, we didn't have these little episodes, but we've had this very solid continuum of Americans who live in the mountains, who have come down from the mountains to shape the way Americans have thought and have lived, and who have said, you know, we may be part of a little minority, but it's a very important part of the American legacy, the very richest part of American legacy, to push us to recognize our social injustices and to correct them. And I told him the story about the civil rights movement exactly in the town where we were reading that night. He didn't know that the first school to integrate in the South was in Clinton, Tennessee, in a little school up in the Cumberland.
Right.
And there was a secret memo that said if the Mountaineers resist integration, then it'll be easy for the rest of the South to resist it. And once again, it was a small group of people who took it on themselves to make sure it happened. And even if there perhaps wasn't a majority in that point, there perhaps was a majority that favored segregation, a strong minority who truly stuck to the great American values of justice and equality and freedom and racial integration made it happen and showed the rest of the South how they could go on.
Yeah, not to give anything away, because I want people to buy your book, and I want to, you know what, I would be thrilled to death, Jeff. I think people should get hold of the book, and having read it, should start militating with their school systems, because virtually every school system teaches some level of state history somewhere around 8th grade, 9th grade, 10th grade maybe. This book should at the very least be in every high school library in every state within the confines of what we call Appalachia. It should actually be required reading in the state history course. Like I said, not to give away too much, but Rosa Parks. Rosa Parks, who passed away recently, Dr. King, Coretta King, all had connections to this mountaineering freedom movement.
Right. You know, when did you hear it during the when we lost Sister Rosa recently? When did we hear that 4 months before she refused to give up her seat, She took a seat at an integration training workshop led by Mountaineers in the Eastern Tennessee, you know, the Highlander Folk School, which is co-founded by Don West, who was also eventually set up a folk school in West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And here was this incredible legacy of Mountaineers who had started in 1932 to work with labor organizations and farm workers. And they went to one of the most depressed parts of the Eastern Tennessee Mountains. They said, we have the wherewithal to change our role in society. We can change how our destiny is going to be shaped. We don't need to be shaped by outside people. They worked with the labor movement. They worked with farm workers. And from day one, they were integrated schools, one of the few places in the entire South where black and white could sit down together and eat together and share the same dormitories. And it's there that Rosa Parks went in 1955, and she said, this is the first time I've met a white man I can trust. You know, there really was that element of so many activists in the South who felt like there was no support behind them, and they realized there was this incredible legacy of laborers and farm workers who were willing to stick their neck out on behalf of the early civil rights movement. And to me, what's really fascinating is this role of the Mountaineers to be catalysts, not just a place where nothing has changed for 200 years, but the contrary, it's been the great crossroads. And I'll give you a good example. In the 1940s, 1946, some black tobacco workers came to Highlander Folk School. And they said, there's an old African-American ballad we're singing here out of the gospel, but we're singing on our picket lines. The Mountaineers heard it and said, yeah, that's nice, but let's give it a little bit more of a rhythm, a good old mountain tune. And Pete Seeger came that same year and changed the word from will to shall, and it became, of course, we shall overcome. And it was Mountaineers who were training the young shock troops, the young students from Nashville and all the other schools. And it was basically from their training up in the mountains, they came back into the lowlands and really launched the civil rights movement.
You know, this kind of stuff, Jeff, and I'm not exaggerating. It makes the little hairs stand up on the back of my neck.
Right.
This is exciting stuff. Let me ask you if with all the research you did, Jeff, and all the history that you learned in order to be able to write this book, do you feel comfortable with any level of not prognostication, but can you project into the future where Appalachia goes?
You know, that's a good question, and I think it's hopefully the kind of question and discussions this book will generate. You know, I view history not as something that's preserved in a museum, but history is this great living organism that serves as a prologue to our future. And then if we're going to understand who we are as a country, we have to understand our past. And just as I wrote in my book, you can't understand America until you understand Appalachia, because that's where so much of our founding moments have come out of. And I think in the same respect, if we're going to act in the future, if we're going to act on the future on behalf of our children and our children's children and really make Appalachia a beautiful place to live, just like our own country, the United States, we've really got to look to the past and see these critical and pivotal moments when people have made that extra step, these great innovators and these great risk takers and these great folks who really have gone against the current to change the way we live in America. In fact, someone recently said that was just, it's a book about those people down there. And I said, no, this is a book about America. It's about how America was shaped by Mountaineers. It's not necessarily a book only about Appalachia, but it really shows Appalachia's incredible influence on the rest of the country.
Well, you mentioned a personal hero of mine, W.C. Handy. He was born in the community where I was born.
Oh, wow. Great.
Down in the Shoals area of Alabama.
Sure.
And Nina Simone, the rise of the so-called hillbilly music is there. I feel like I have to ask you one question, though, because it's toward the end of your book. And in asking you about a projection into the future, you do make mention of something that we have to deal with, especially in West Virginia, in Western Virginia, in Kentucky, in some parts of Tennessee, and that is mountaintop removal.
Right. You know, I think I try to tell the media there's a dual crisis going on right now in mining. You know, I come from a coal mining family. My grandfather barely survived a cave-in in southern Illinois. He had pieces of coal still stuck in his head. The company doctor tried to take out pieces, but then basically got bored with it and walked away. And so my grandfather literally lived with coal embedded in his head, and he was ravaged by black lung. But he was very, very much defiant and very proud of the fact that the unions had done so much to work with the coal mining communities. And, of course, he's the one, like Don West, that always reminded me that Mother Jones is buried in our graveyard in southern Illinois, and she's not buried in West Virginia. She was a great labor leader also for our people.
Mm-hmm.
But there needs to, I think, have a reckoning with our coal industry today. You know, a few years ago, I was on a foreign assignment in Mexico, and I got a letter from my uncle. And he wrote, "It's all gone, Jeff. The four plum trees, the pond, the forest where you children would play. Our 200-year-old homestead was destroyed by strip mining, essentially mountaintop removal. In that same area that took my grandfather's life, essentially, in the coal mines, took our 200 years of history." And so it hit me very hard that we're often divided in the coal communities between those who support the unions and the coal miners and those who are so-called environmentalists. And it makes me laugh because there was no greater environmentalist than my grandfather, who would dig ginseng and who loved the forest, and my grandmother, who knew all the herbs and collected them, and you know, people who lived off the land, who also dug coal as part of their career. And I feel like what I want to do with my book is, and some other writers are coming out as well now, is to say we need to bridge between these two communities, between the environmentalist and the coal mining communities, to realize that we've reached a reckoning with our coal community, that if we continue with mountaintop removal, we're going to have a calamity on the size of Hurricane Katrina in the back forest, because what they're doing is destroying the natural erosion routes and the gullies and the waterways by literally dumping those mountains in. And they're eventually going to take our coal mining jobs that are left away from us because they're going to be destroying communities.
Well, have you heard the latest news out of eastern Kentucky?
As of the last 24 hours?
Well, no, I mean as of the last couple of weeks. Massey Energy, and we're not talking here about mountaintop removal. We're talking, and you reminded me because you mentioned your travels in Mexico, Massey Energy circulated a memo stating that the work ethic of the Appalachian coal miner has degraded and that basically they're just a bunch of OxyContin-eating no-good hillbillies now.
Right.
And petitioned the government of the state of Kentucky for the right to bring in non-English-speaking Mexican coal miners.
Right.
And
right.
You know, there's not a bigoted bone in my body, but the last thing I want to see is miners brought in who are simply being brought in to go into the hole and die.
Right. You know, and complete travesty in terms of the law and safety issues, not to have signs, of course, in Spanish and whatnot. And I mean, I think that's what they're trying to get around is you have not only cheap labor, but labor that's disposable. And, of course, as you know, Bob, this is not the first time. You know, early immigrants were brought in early on to break the labor movement.
Sure. Hungarians, Poles, Italians.
Blacks.
Yeah.
You know, and I feel like, and we should know, we should look back at our history that, you know, this is a typical situation from outside companies who want to try to do this.
Well, that was one of the other things you pointed out, and you know, these various peoples were brought in as an attempt to break the back of that fledgling union, the UMWA, and they were brought, but instead they formed the backbone of it in many places. And you note and correctly, and I wish people. I hope people will learn more about it, that the UMWA was integrated from the get-go.
Right. Day one, it was an incredibly integrated union. And also, I try to remind people, we talk about the Battle of Blair's Mountain, of course, which is an incredibly historic event. You know, you had 20% and 30% of the columns that were marching were black miners. And some of the people who testified later, some of the leaders of the union, in fact, one in particular had been an African slave at one point in Virginia, who then became a West Virginia coal miner. And I think that's what, to me, as I want to get back to our dueling crisis, I feel like just as we have to really look at the incredible lack of enforcement of mining safety laws right now and the coal slurry ponds that we need to be keeping our eye on and mountaintop removal, what it tells me about all these crises from mining safety to mining top removal is that mining has to become a national issue.
Yes.
It's got to be embraced by people from the north, people from the south, and people from the west and east. And until mountaintop removal, until mining safety becomes a nationally pressed issue, we're still going to have this hodgepodge of law and lack of enforcement and still this kind of split within our own communities. And I feel like this is the great crisis to me, is that just as it took mountain people to say slavery is not a southern institution, it's a national issue, and that civil rights is not a southern question, but it should be a national issue. We now need other people in America to come up the mountain and embrace that mining is a national issue, and that 52% of our people still rely on coal for our electricity in America.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need to come together to come to some reckoning and some ideas to how we can deal with how we coal mine our coal and how we can preserve our mountains.
Well, and I think that's that was the feeling you left me with, Jeff, was that for all of the progress, you know, the very seeds of progress that were born in these hills, that we run a risk in the future of these hills not generating anything else because there won't be anything here left to generate with.
Right, exactly. You know, my question is, if you tear down the hills and the mountains, can you still talk about hill folk and mountaineers? You know, once you destroyed your community, once you've had an incredible flood and washout, and we know in so many places in West Virginia that just are treading on thin ice if there's a wet season.
Yeah.
And I think we essentially have been lucky because, once again, we're in the midst of a drought. But what if it was a really bad rainy season this spring? You know, we have dozens, if not scores, of communities in West Virginia which are treading thin ice because they're in floodplains now. And they've been put in these floodplains because of mountaintop removal. It's so many people who are not only going to lose their job, but they're going to lose their lives. And I feel like that's where we need the people to come together from all angles of West Virginia and all angles of the country to discuss how we can start rebuilding and re-envisioning our energy industry and our economies and our local economies. Because that's really the bottom issue to me is we have to find a way that we can live in wonderful places like West Virginia and be economically self-sufficient and run an economy that benefits everybody.
Exactly, exactly. Jeff, thank you so much for joining us. The book is, I've enjoyed the conversation. The book is just, like I said, mind-boggling with its depth and with the fascination of the facts that are borne out in it. I understand you're traveling about promoting the book?
Yeah, I've been on a tour almost for 2 months now. And I'll be heading your way in about 3 weeks.
Where are you going to be?
I'm going to speak at Taylor Books in Charleston on Friday, May 24th.
Wonderful place. It's my favorite bookstore in Charleston.
Yeah, it's a great bookstore. And once again, the book readings tend to be really nice forums for people not only to hear a reading from the book, but also to bring up a lot of these questions.
Have you been able to get in touch with any of those the people that cover book readings with like C-SPAN?
Yeah, in fact, I was recorded on C-SPAN last Saturday down in South Carolina.
Were you really? Any idea when it airs?
You know, they said in about a month on Book TV.
Well, I hope maybe you can get your publicist to drop us an email so that we can promote that when it comes around. Of course, this program goes out worldwide. Are you limiting your speaking tour to the Appalachian region, or
No, not at all. In fact, once again, with this idea that I didn't write a book about Appalachia, but I wrote a book about how Appalachians have changed America, we're definitely taking the tour to the west and to the east and up into the north. I mean, I like to remind my friends in Detroit who often sort of look at Appalachia as comic relief that, you know, the most dangerous man in Detroit is Walter Reuther, who, of course, came out of the West Virginia mills and a longtime labor family. And you can almost go to every region in the country, and there'll be an incredible influence by someone who's come out of the mountains, either to shape their literature or their society in some impact.
Yeah, and it blows my mind coming back for just one minute more to my heroine out of the book, Anne Royal.
Right.
She was instrumental in getting the first government grant for the telegraph. In so many ways, she's the mother of, in that respect, she's the first blogger. The telegraph was the internet of its age.
Right. And that famous phrase, "What hath God made?" The response was, "Give my regards to Miss Royal," and. You know, West Virginia ought to have, you know, Anne Royal days, and all the children should be studying her. And, you know, when you often, once again, our feminist movement likes to look at figures outside the rural areas. But, in fact, here's this woman who is really the first great feminist, too, but in her own great iconoclastic independent streak. And so you folks, it's just amazing what comes out of West Virginia. Martin Delaney and so many other people, of course, Pearl S. Buck, and so many contemporary people. And that, to me, is the beauty of it, this incredible richness and diversity that, to me, it's the great American story.
It is, I'm the only member of my family that wasn't born in West Virginia.
Okay.
I was born in Alabama, but that's where I was born still qualifies as part of the Appalachians. And I felt myself drawn back here. And there are a lot of people that they worked in the auto plants or the tire plants in toward the north, and they come back here at their retirement. This, you know, these mountains really do call you home.
Right.
And so I hope that you can find, as you travel the country, I hope that you can find those people, because, you know, they're still out there.
Right.
And the next question is to find out who the next generation of Appalachians will be that, again, will shake the country.
Right, exactly. And the issues, I think, are coming daily, you know, and I think be it with how we deal with our new tourism economy, with our new immigration issues, with the scope of coal mining and the beginning and the ends of whatnot, and how we save our land and how we shape a future for our children, and I think the issues are just going to be endless. And I feel like Appalachia is going to be a great place to live, because I know Appalachians have always been there to come down and deal with them, and they always will be.
Are you working on another project?
You know, I've got a book on the Sierra Madre coming out in September.
Oh, that'll be fascinating.
I spent a year living down the Sierra Madre of Mexico, and many of the same issues, too, of how that place has been sort of demonized and mythologized. And, in fact, it's a wonderful part of Mexico.
I try to be a little bit of a student of pre-Columbian Mexico.
Mm.
And, of course, all of the peoples that inhabited the very region you're talking about, there are isolated pockets there to this day that still speak the Nahuatl, you know, some form of the Nahuatl that was that was spoken at the time that Cortez arrived.
Oh yeah, very ancient populations.
Ask your publicist please to let me know when that one comes out. I'd love to have you back, and we'll chat about that a little
great.
Bit.
Well, listen, Bob, thanks so much for having me on your
such
program.
A pleasure, Jeff.
And you know, one thing I do tell everybody is that this book is it's a labor of love, and it is a uphill battle. You know, I think often we need to remind our friends who do live in other cities outside the region that if they're going to turn on the TV and watch Saturday Night Live and Hillbilly ER, that they also need to pick up a book like this. And that I think it's what I need is as much help as possible of spreading that word outside the region. And so I really appreciate your help in that.
Well, you're talking right now to folks all over the west coast of the United States. We've got listeners in every state in the nation.
Great.
And I can guarantee you, you're talking to some folks across the pond, too. So we're getting the word out.
That's great. Listen, thank you so much.
You take care, Jeff, and best of luck.
Okay, take care.
Bye now. And I'll be in touch and find out where Jeff is going to be when. If you get a chance, you know, I wish my copy was autographed. But if you get a chance, go and see him when he appears. I don't just get all gushy about a book very often. This is extremely good writing. It's engaging, and like I said, you'd be surprised. You know, I talk to people in on the West Coast, and they go, "Well, you know, great granny was from Eastern Kentucky, or you know, great granddad came from Virginia." This book really does chronicle the reality of what this region, this threatened, this endangered region, means to America. It's literally our seed ground. And when you stop to think for even 1 minute, when you just pause to reflect that 3 million pounds of explosives are used on just West Virginia every day, can you not help but wonder if that seed ground can long remain fertile? When you think about the fact that Massey and their pals drop one Hiroshima bomb on Appalachia every week and a half or so, does it become apparent that Appalachia is a threatened region? That there is as much a war on this place, this precious place in the United States, as there is on the ravages of the Amazon rainforest? But Sting can't quite find his way up the holler here. We're not quite as romantic. We've just got to do, and it's like it's always been, all we've got to do is do all the hard work ourselves. Let's take a break. This is Head On. I'm Bob Kincaid.
When I was a child, my family would travel down to Western Kentucky, where my parents were born. And there's a backwards old town that's often remembered so many times that my memories are worn. And Daddy won't
won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River, where paradise lay. Well, I'm sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's coal train has hauled it away. Well, sometimes we'd travel right down the Green River to the abandoned old prison down by Avery Hill, where the air smelled like snakes and we'd shoot with our pistols, but empty pop bottles was all we would kill. And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River where paradise lay. Well, I'm sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's coal train has hauled it away. And the coal company came with the world's largest shovel, and they tortured the timber and stripped all the land. Well, they dug for their coal till the land was forsaken, then they rode it all down as the progress of man. And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River where paradise lay. Well, I'm sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's coal train has hauled it away. When I die, let my ashes float down the Green River. Let my soul roll on up to the Rochester Dam. I'll be halfway to heaven with paradise waiting, just 5 miles away from wherever I am. And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River where paradise lay. Well, I'm sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's coal train has hauled it away.
Alrighty then, welcome back. Never mind the PSAs. We can hear about the obesity stuff and all of it some other time. Just a little interlude is all. That was a well-spent hour. It's 7 minutes before the hour. Again, the link to the book. The link to the book. If you go to the White Rose Society website, where you go to pick up the stream, whiterosesociety.org/kincaid.html. Then you'll find a direct link to purchase this book. And it will be a book, if you love your American history, that you will come back to again and again and again and again. Because what you'll find out of this is that every good thing, every time America has been in trouble, every time America has faced crisis, a big part of the solution has had its birthing in these hills and hollers of Appalachia. Whether it was determined die-hard mountaineers on a forced march to King's Mountain to stop the loyalist forces and put the kibosh on what would have gone on to be the destruction of Washington's army, whether that the Battle of King's Mountain, or as Jeff mentioned, this is the very essence of the civil rights movement. Music. The Carter family. If you love your country music, or your folk and your bluegrass, in modern parlance, it begins with the Carter family showing up at a talent search in their Sunday best. It's Pearl S. Buck taking mountain sentiments and applying them to the Chinese world in which she grew up. It is, as Jeff noted, Jeff Biggers, the author, it's Walter Reuther becoming the most dangerous man in Detroit. and he was only dangerous because he believed that working people, because, you know, he came from working stock in West Virginia, he just happened to believe that working people deserved to be treated like something besides dogs. And dragged, well, dragged General Motors into something resembling a recognition of human rights via all his efforts with the United Auto Workers. This the example after example after example is there for the, you know, for the learning. Because, like I said, I didn't know a bunch of this stuff. Let's go to the phones. David is with us from Nashville, a student, I will warrant, of some of this history.
Well, you know, Bob, I try to be. Being born in Middle Tennessee, growing up in Eastern Tennessee, a lot of what that fine gentleman was speaking about rings ever so true. I can remember the Knoxville Journal, the morning Republican paper, day after day after day, at least once a month, and in some cases once a week. There was an article about the evil Highlander Communist School.
Well, there were billboards calling them commies, weren't there?
Oh, you bet there were. I knew families that just were irritated and concerned and just flabbergasted that somebody hadn't burned it down. You could find high school students that would go on to college, good college careers, that would say, why don't we get a bunch of kids together and just go burn down? Let's go find that Highlander school. Let's go, that thing up there with the communists. Let's go burn it down.
God almighty.
So you and the gentleman agree that mountain culture, mountain people, mountains in general might be threatened, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. Not might be, are.
May I offer a bedrock aspect of why that's probably true?
Do please.
And, you know, there's a lot of modern parlance, and I get it thrown at me at work and all day long. I get these duplicitous phrases, you know, kind of like George talking about Clean Air Act and No Child Behind Left and all the rest of that. Perversions and corruptions of language, and it's so horrid.
Right.
And that's why it's so funny to me, as an aside, it's so incredibly funny to me and just heartening when Wayne or you do your little shtick about emboldened. You know, that puts a little fire behind the eyes. I just love that a lot, but mountain culture, mountain people, mountain values are indeed in serious trouble because, Bob, my understanding of the mountain person, first and foremost, almost before anything else, other than family, other than his feelings about his or her feelings about God, is their desire to simply be left alone.
Isn't that, yeah.
Bob, they don't reach out very well because what they can pull to them, whether it's a freshly killed rabbit, a nicely knitted sweater, or a jug of good whiskey.
Hear, hear.
They've got it within their own power to do that, and they would like everybody else that they haven't known since birth to leave them the hell alone. And in so doing, they are perceived as not bright, less interested. And in modern parlance, Bob, they ain't proactive, which means...
Oh, God, not proactive.
Proactive means I'm going to reach out and take from you what I think I'd like to have.
I'm going to mind your business for a while.
Mountain folks don't do that.
Nope. Don't take
folks. Mountain folks wait for invites. Mountain folks support blood. And mountain folks enjoy a little solitude. And out of that comes their greatest danger.
I agree. Because having cherished our solitude, we make it easy to be ignored. or easy to...
And since they're not out there pushing what is theirs on somebody else's, they're perceived as not caring, and there is nothing further from the truth.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the fact of the matter is, David, well, you know, I go back, the Washington District was a fascinating story in this book. And that's the first example of a bunch of people, and they weren't hoodlums, and they weren't outlaws, and you know, ne'er-do-wells. These were people who were moving away from the settlements and had a bunch of money backing them to do it. And they just wanted, whether it was the colonial government or the locals, the British, they wanted to be left the hell alone. And they wanted to establish their own relations. In that particular instance, it was a relationship with the Cherokee Nation. And these were smart people too, because the British had said, "Well, you know, you can't buy land from the Indians; that is forbidden." And these people said, "Okay, we won't. We'll lease it." And they did, and they thrived, and they flourished.
They came to terms with the people around them in a manner that had balance and equilibrium. And Indians, if there's anything an Indian can come to terms with, is balance.
Well, exactly. And one of the early movers and shakers in the Washington District movement went on to be a grandsire of Sequoia. And what does that tell you? I mean, that's not exactly a gang of lawless renegades, is it?
No, indeed. And Sequoia is one of the great, genuinely great thinkers, great minds, great men in all of American history, worthy of any level of study anybody wants to put into him. And he has that, you know, he's got that white guy in his background that got it.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, and I know, you know, your fascination with music, well, the book is worth getting for the. It starts out with a musical history, and it's just mind-boggling stuff.
Well, if he's going to write about Appalachia, he's got to write about music, and I'm sure he did.
Oh yeah, and not just the Carter family. Like I said, W.C. Handy, Nina Simone. My God, it just goes on and on and on, and you come away from it just baffled. That's the question I keep asking. Out of the and I had a pretty good education. How did I miss this?
Well, you didn't spend the time researching just that he did. You know, you touched on various topics within your life.
But
was that the King of Siam, from flower to flower to flower?
From bee to bee to bee, exactly. Hey, David, thanks so much. And if you run across anybody of this bent, please tell them about this book.
Oh, I shall. Oh, I'm sure I'll hear about it. My guess is he'll make Davis Kid here in Nashville before it's over.
I'll check the schedule because I've got it laying around. Yeah.
Oh, if he doesn't do Davis Kid, and if the nice lady whose name escapes me at the moment on WPLN, the public radio station here in Nashville, if she, Rebecca Bain, if she doesn't interview him for her weekly writer's show, I will be sorely disappointed.
Well, let us know. And if you get a chance to go out and see him, please do so.
Oh, yeah. And I'll pester Rebecca.
All right. You take care, David.
Good night, Bob. Thanks.
Bye
for
now. Yes, indeed. Let's take a quick break and come back with more of your phone calls. I want to get right back to the phones. I think it's... I'll be interested to hear your thoughts on what you heard. This is Head On. I'm Bob Kincaid.
If I could save time in a bottle, the first thing that I'd like to do is to save every day till eternity passes away, just to spend them with you. If I could make days last forever, if words could make wishes come true, I'd save every day like a treasure, and then again I would could spend them with you. But there never seems to be.
You know, the president came out and talked about the Iraq War and how he had a strategy to win the peace. I have some exclusive audio. This is actually him preparing for the speech in front of the mirror. This is him laying out the strategy for Iraq.
That was the most coherent thing I've heard him say in ages, man.
You know, if he really spoke that way, it would be so much better for us all. Because at least then we would know that he's an incoherent bastard. We could have him locked up.
And that's just a taste of what Bruce and I got up to last weekend. Come and join us next weekend, Saturday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. To get the stream details, go to 4thestateradio.com. That's 4thestateradio.com.
Told you it was going to be quick. This is Head On. I'm Bob Kincaid. The phone number, of course, 877, the number 4, Head On, 877-443-2366. And straight back to the phones, someone we haven't heard from in a long, long time, our good friend Judy. Hey, Judy, you're Head On.
Hey, Bob, how you doing?
I'm doing very well. How about you?
Oh, well, a lot better since I've heard Jeff Boogers on your show.
Isn't he just amazing?
Oh, that was so great. I discovered that book, I think about a month ago, and I've been reading bits and pieces of it, but I'm going to wait till he comes to Charleston to purchase the book because I want his autograph.
Absolutely. Well, you know, you were the one that turned me on to it in the first place, so I have there's a debt of gratitude involved.
Well, you would have found it sooner or later, but I tried to push forward everything I can so that you can stay on top of those things.
Well, this is it's a marvelous, marvelous book, and more than anything else, Judy, it's an affirmation. It affirms the strength of character that infuses this region.
I am so proud of to be an Appalachian American, and I'm just so grateful that so many authors are writing books about Appalachia and about West Virginia and Kentucky, and I think that we're finally getting our due. And for so many years, we've been the butt of many jokes.
That's true.
And it makes me swell with pride to think that people are writing such great things about us, things that I knew in my heart that we were, you know, actually we started the Revolutionary War.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that. And I just need to hear someone else say, hey, those people in Appalachia are really good people, and they're brave, and they're strong, and they populated America.
And, among, you know, we're always good for a fight, you know, Judy?
You know what? That's the only time that they seem to want us around is when there's a good fight.
Yeah, well, yeah, we're the best in the world to have at your back. The numbers, West Virginia has given more, and Appalachia in general has given more to every war effort than any other region in the country.
Yeah.
It just is what it is. But moreover, to be able to take that pride you're talking about, and apply it, and you know, for me to tell stories out of this book, there's not a story in this book that isn't fit for telling to a kid. And they need to know that. They need to know that the soil that is giving rise to them has given rise to geniuses and patriots and inventors and visionaries. I mean, is there anything more visionary than what went on at the Highland School?
Absolutely. And you know, I didn't know Nina Simone was from West Virginia.
No, she's not a West Virginia. She's in North Carolina.
North Carolina. I didn't know she was from Appalachia. It shocked me.
It blew my mind.
It shocked me too. It really did. But I'm just so proud to be, you know, an Appalachian American and be part of this and to have this dialect that I have. A lot of people, you look at you real funny, like, only a real West Virginian or Kentuckian can tell whether that dialect is a just plain Southern drawl or whether it's really Kentucky or West Virginian.
Well, you know, that's so true. I was on the phone with one of the tech guys today in my travails earlier today dealing with some of the technical issues here at the studio, and I got patched over to this one guy, and I talked to him for about 30 minutes working out stuff, and I finally said, "Where are you?" He said, "Charleston." I said, "West Virginia?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "I knew it."
Yeah.
I knew it. And because, you know, it doesn't go away, and it's rich and it's beautiful and it's precious, and it deserves to be cherished.
It really does. A lot of people just, you know, I've heard some people on TV just sling slurs, you know, about, you know, the West Virginia, they call it the hillbilly talk, and I thought to myself, You just really don't understand what you're saying. You know, you just really don't understand how rich and how cultural, and this is true Elizabethan English with a little bit of Scots-Irish and a little bit of Southern twang thrown in there. It's the real deal. It's the real thing. And I know Patty and I went to Silverado, California to give a roadshow, and the people there were fighting development in their canyon. And before we left, we had those people calling their canyon a holler. And that's what it was. It's a holler.
Sure it is.
Yeah. And they wanted us to teach them a little bit of our dialect. So I taught them how to say, "Yank from around, here are you." And they loved it. And they just really loved our dialect, you know, and thought it was really quaint. And of course, I loved it, and, you know, I thought, you should listen to someone in Mingo County talk.
Oh, yeah. Good. Because it gets broader and deeper the further you go. Well, let me take you a little bit of field, if I could, Judy. Mm-hmm. Tell me, you're an activist in your own right. What's going on in your fight?
Well, I just got back from Washington, D.C. We went to D.C., to get some more sponsors for H.R. 2719, which is the Clean Water Protection Act. And that's the Clean Water Act that the Bush administration gutted to allow mountaintop removal to continue because we had filed a lawsuit. They found out we were wrong, so they changed the law instead of obeying the law.
Well, right. Yeah.
Right.
That was one of those clarifications, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, that's one of those clarifications.
They have to clarify because the rest of the world can understand it, but they're too dim to figure it out. Well, you know, greed will blind you as well as kill.
Absolutely. So we just came back from D.C., and it's a big success. A gentleman named Will Orr with USGS has a new PowerPoint presentation. It's called a virtual flyover. And I know you know about Earth Google.
Mm-hmm.
And so he takes the basis of Earth Google, and he takes you on he took the congressman and their aides on a virtual flyover. And boy, let me tell you, it can make you dizzy. And it's literally like flying over.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. He had done some studies in which he found out that the Appalachian coal is you've heard of peak oil production.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Appalachian coal is past its peak. We're on the downside. And he has facts and figures to prove that. It was just an amazing point.
Well, you know, that goes a long way to explaining why all of a sudden we're hearing about this fascination with the Montana coal fields.
Absolutely.
And the sad thing is, we know how ugly mountaintop removal is here. It's going to be as bad or worse in Montana.
They're digging huge pits there. Yeah, mm-hmm. and it's going to be bad. It's going to be bad. But, you know, when you hear the West Virginia Coal Association saying, "Oh, there's 300 years of coal left," well,
nah.
Where's it left at? It's not in West Virginia.
No, it's not.
Kentucky. I heard from a friend of mine in Kentucky that they're trying to map out coal reserves, and they're finding out that Kentucky doesn't have as much coal as they first thought. So they're here for literally the last of the coal.
Yeah.
Rape and run. Yeah, snatch and grab. And the thing is,
these good jobs that mountaintop removal provides, you know, one, there aren't that many of those, and B, they're not gonna be there when the coal's not there.
No.
There's not going to be a retraining program.
No. And this mono economy that we've boxed ourselves into here in West Virginia is going to be the downfall. We need total reconstruction. And my grandma always told me, don't ever put all your eggs in one basket, honey. And that's basically what West Virginia has done. And we need to diversify our economy, and we need to do so quickly.
Well, you know, that's interesting you would bring that up, Judy, because one of the things that did move me out of Jeff Biggers' book is the model that he presents from that Highland School.
Mm-hmm.
That needs to, at least as far as I'm concerned, that needs to be replicated. And to a large extent, you know, you with your organization, Coal River Mountain Watch, the folks at OVEC, the folks at Highlands Conservancy, you're following that model in a way.
In a way, yes.
And I think that's the right direction to go in.
Absolutely. What you do is you take past successes and you mold them to fit your movement, and that's what we've tried to do. And you modify it slightly because people just are so just attached to the TV set now, and you know, looking at Desperate Housewives and, you know, things like that, rather than, you know, paying attention to what really is going on in the world today. And they better be paying attention. They had daggone better be paying attention to what's going on.
You're so right, because literally, and I think Jeff has a good handle on this. We're not living in the present. We're literally living the future, Judy.
Yeah.
I mean, the future is happening all around us. It's the honest questions that some of us are asking as to, you know, every generation, you know, and I'm sure, you know it just as well. It's always said, you know, I had it better than my parents had it.
Yes.
We're coming to a place that my generation can't say that. We can't say that about our kids.
We can't. And our the problem is our children are looking at shiny objects. They're being hypnotized by shiny objects so that they can't see what the future holds for them.
Well, they're dumbed down. They're drugged down.
Mercury?
Yeah.
Mercury, yeah. Mercury's done that to them, and they can't understand. And I really do think that our children are looking for something. They know something is not right with this world, and they can't quite put their finger on it, and that's because they're brainwashed from kindergarten. You know, they environmentally, we are abusing our children. Our children have no future. They won't even have the basic necessities such as clean air or clean water, and we're stealing that from our children. And if we continue to use up all the resources, they'll have no energy resources either. And it really makes me sad. That's what I strive to do by talking to colleges, and we have a lot of college students involved in this, and I'm pushing for those college students to try to organize high school students organize junior high and grade school students to take back their future, take back their earth, take back their lives. And that's what I'm hoping for. I think they're looking for something, and I think this is what they need to look for. They need to take back their earth.
Well, Judy, where's the Mountaintop Removal Roadshow going next?
Well, we have some students that want to come in for a tour of our area. So we have some students, junior high students, that are coming in, I think from Ohio on the 8th and 9th, and then we have some more students coming in from Ohio on the 18th and 19th. We have some students that are coming in from New York City I think it's the first week of April, April the 10th. That's when they're coming in. And so we're planning on a road show to Pittsburgh and one to Philadelphia, and Dave Cooper has his road show going, and he'll be going in Illinois, and we have some plans we have to start making. And, of course, we have Mountain Justice Summer coming up again this year.
Absolutely. Well, you mentioned the Pittsburgh trip. We've got friends and listeners in the Pittsburgh area.
Really?
When's that going to happen, Judy?
Well, I will have to get back to you on that.
Please do.
On that. Vernon and Janice are going on that trip. And we like to give them a little bit of diversity.
Sure, sure.
And so Vernon and Janice are going on that trip. And let's see, and we have several offers for Earth Day. And we've got three people going in three different directions. I think our main focus will be at the Pipestem at the Appalachian Folklife Center this year.
Mm-hmm.
We've been invited there. So I think that's basically where we're going this year. So we'll be on the road. Oh, and the UN, secured a talk with the United Nations in New York City in May.
My goodness gracious.
So we're going to take our flight to the United Nations, and we'll see basically what our problem is, and you know this, is not only the environmental aspects of mountaintop removal, but our government continues to ignore the genocide that's taking place in Appalachia. When you blow up our mountains, you're destroying our culture, our heritage, our future, and our past. And so we have several things up and coming. And what I'm going to do is send you a calendar of what we're doing.
Please do. Please do.
Yes.
Because among other things, you know, there are a lot of folks who are very active in their own communities, Judy, all over this country and all over the world now, who listen to this program. And I'd love to provide some means for them to get in touch with you, if they'd like to have the roadshow come out. A lot of our listeners hang out in the Tom Hartman chat room, and I was chatting in there with them one night. I posted a link to some of the photos there at crmw.net and some of the photographs at ovec.org. And there were people in the chat rooms who were flabbergasted by what they'd seen.
No, they had no idea.
They couldn't believe that this can happen in America.
Well, I will definitely send you Dave Cooper's roadshow list, our roadshow list, and our list of upcoming events. And we're having a movie premiere this coming Saturday in South Charleston. And I'll send you the information on that. It's Black Diamonds, a movie that Anne and Catherine Pancake has taken, I think, about 5 years to make. And you can literally see me age in that movie. No special effects, no nothing. You can literally see my hair turn gray in that movie. And I can't wait to see it. And, of course, we have a big spread, and Vanity Fair is doing a green issue. And they're doing a huge spread on mountaintop removal. And, of course, you know National Geographic this month. They have a huge spread on mountaintop removal as well.
And I saw a very nice article from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. There was a link sent to me, I believe, just today.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of photographs of our friend Maria Gonneau.
Yeah.
You guys are doing an amazing, admirable, heroic job. I mean, this is, as far as I'm concerned, we've been inundated with fake patriotism and false patriotism, Judy. You're engaged in the real stuff.
Well, absolutely. We are the real deal. We're the real people fighting literally for our lives. There are people in Mingo County, Bob, their children have kidney stones. Six-year-old children have kidney stones, and it's from the underground injection from the sludge dams over there, and these people are being poisoned, and they have been poisoned for the last 5 to 6 years. And they're just now beginning to speak out because they've heard other people speak out. And a lot of people just don't understand that in West Virginia and Kentucky, the coal industry still has that yoke of oppression on us and still controls people. And people are afraid and intimidated.
Well, you know, it's so often the case that you've got that, you know, help comes for situations like this from areas outside the immediate region. I had sound bites a week or so ago from a lady whose husband was killed in the Jim Walker mine explosion down in Alabama back in 2001, and the first person to reach out to her was Paul Wellstone, senator from Minnesota.
Oh, yes.
And so I know that you're making some headway in Washington with people outside the West Virginia area. Let me ask you this, Judy, are you making any headway with any of the political leaders inside West Virginia?
Very few. We do have some people that signed on to our sludge bill, you know, and that's literally to stop any more sludge dams. No more sludge dams, no more underground sludge injections, and it got stalled in Morris in his committee.
Mm-hmm.
And they just doomed it to a committee, but this is the first year. As of yet, we don't have anyone with the courage to introduce the bill to ban mountaintop removal strip mining.
Well, Well, that day will come, and that person will eventually be hailed as a visionary.
But, you know, though, the problem is this is a federal issue, and I think as a region, Appalachia needs to work as a region to ban it regionally.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that would be a federal law, and in that essence, you know, Appalachia is trying to restore the Clean Water Act for all of America, not just for us.
Right.
But this benefits all of America.
Well, yeah, it's gonna, the nexus of concerns, the cattlemen on the ranges out west are gonna need to understand what it is that the mountaintop removal the protest movement is doing here, because when the stuff starts up, and it already is started, I mean the Powder River Range in Wyoming, what's going on and it's going to happen in Montana is going to be poison, absolute poison for every living thing around there.
Absolutely.
And they need to hurry. They need to understand that that's what's coming, and they need to get on the bus.
And they're pushing the Navajo off the Black Mesa Mountain. They're trying their best to push those people off their lands again for the coal there, and they're taking their water. And so we're looking at a big battle coming up there. And so we're making connections out west, and we're finding out that there are people out there that's willing to fight this as well.
Well, you know, you're doing an excellent job of, there's one of those modern words I despise, but you're doing an excellent job of networking. And it's not networking, it's the recognition of common goals and common ambitions, common dreams and common hopes, and you are you're doing such a marvelous job with it.
We just want the basics, Bob. We just want clean air and clean water. We want to be able to live in peace. That's all we want. That's all we're asking for. We're asking for a future for our children. You know, this earth was not given to us, you know, to tear up. We're just holding this earth in trust. This earth belongs to the Lord, and we're holding it in trust for our children. And people need to realize that.
Well, I think more people are realizing that, Judy. At least, you know, I hope. I seem to hear it. I seem to see it. You know, it's the exposure that you're getting, and that stuff that you and the other folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, the folks at OVEC, the Highlands Conservancy, all these groups, you have made so much of that happen. And yet, you know, you're still fighting battles literally in your own backyard. It blows my mind that there is a wind farm project in Greenbrier County, West Virginia, that will the cleanest of clean energy. And you've got a bunch of people who are howling about the fact that it's going to impede their, what's the word they use?
Viewscape. Their view shed.
Yeah, their view shed, their viewscape. And I got to, you know.
I have to tell you, Bob, that literally is a slap in my face.
Yes, it is.
You know, I'll take those wind farms. I'll take those. You can have the mountaintop removal and the coal-fired power plants and the sludge dams over your schools. You know, come and live, come and walk in our shoes, and it's amazing how one man's trash is another man's treasure.
It is, and frankly, you know me, Judy, I'm a little bit of a cynic. I'm firmly convinced that the people that are all hot and heavy opposing those windmills in Greenbrier County, you know who's got that kind of money.
Yes, we know who's got that kind of money, and we've thought for a long time. You know, there's some coal money backing some of these people that don't want wind farms in their areas, and not entirely, but we think there's some backing of it. And you know, I've read some of the letters sent to the PSC. Anybody can go online and read them. And one man from there actually says that he thinks that there are some fossil fuel interests backing this.
Well, you know, the heroin dealer is not out. It doesn't take kindly when people hit the streets trying to get people to get clean and sober, does he?
No, he doesn't like that. Well, they're having a hearing April. I think it's April the 25th up in Greenbrier County there, and that's going to be interesting.
I should think so. Hey, Judy, thanks so much. I hope we'll hear from you again soon. I love our conversations.
Oh, you will, definitely. I'm been sick for this entire month, but I'm getting over it. I think a lot of people have been sick. Welcome to global warming.
Yeah.
So you know, I look forward to calling you back again, and I'm still having a little problem. You come and go.
Oh.
Yeah, but I'll get it. It's because I'm on dial-up, you know. Charter hasn't reached the top of the hill yet.
I understand.
Yeah.
We'll keep our fingers crossed.
Definitely, and I just love listening to you, and thanks for the great show again tonight.
Oh, thank you, Judy. Okay. You have a wonderful evening.
You too.
Say hi to everybody for me, please.
Definitely.
All right, bye now.
Bye-bye.
And let's see. Agnes says take a break. So take a break we will. If you're on hold, please stick with us. You're listening to Head On. This is going to be one of those fun nights.
So if you believe in that God, and if you believe in those spiritual tenets, as 80% of these people that I just read in this poll, supposedly they say they believe in them, you know, is that fantasy world, or is that real world? I mean, if they really believe in those tenets, if they really believe in that religion, if they really believe in that Christ, then why do we have a war going on? And why do we have people starving? And why do we have people homeless? And why do we have, you know, all of this injustice in society? And why are African Americans killed at three times the rate of white Americans in our prisons in execution chairs? I'll tell you why. Because we have a long way to go to make this society an equitable one. We have a long way to go to create the kind of society that our spiritual principles tell us we need to have. Hey, this is Bruce Birch, and I'd like to invite you to join me each and every Sunday evening at 10 p.m. Eastern for All Things Reconsidered, the weekly program that takes a progressive look at the week in politics. For connection information and archives of all of my shows, point your browser to allthingsreconsidered.org. That's allthingsreconsidered.org.
Okay, listen up. If you're sick of hearing lies by right-wing corporate pukes who like to pretend they stand up for the working guy, then head over to the Cup of Joe radio show, where the truth will hit you so hard you'll have to wear your hard hat. You can listen to the screaming audio at cupojoe.blogspot.com. That's cupojoe.blogspot.com. Now get back to work.
Alrighty then, back at it. Halfway done. this Wednesday night prayer meeting edition, and by golly, I think we got a dandy one going with the choir tonight. Let's waste no time and go straight back to the phones. Nanette is with us. Hey, Nanette, you're head on.
Hi, Bob. How are you doing?
Doing good. You?
I'm doing fine. I just wanted to call and say I just really enjoyed your interview this evening.
Well, thank you very much. I had a blast doing it.
I can't wait till he comes to Taylor Books. I'm going to go see him.
I'm kind of going to be here, but I wish I could go. I'd love to get my book signed.
Yeah, I'm not going to get mine offline. I'm going to go to the store and get mine.
Well, go down there, get it at the signing, and meet him. What a knowledgeable fella.
Yes. He's done a lot of work in this.
Oh, he's poured a whole lot of time into it. It's obvious. And, you know, like he said, it all begins with, for him, it began with a meeting with Don West.
Mm-hmm.
And, it changed his life. It changed the way he looked at the world. And, we have that effect on people.
Yeah, I just wish that more people could come here and talk to folks here.
Well,
I think it would eliminate a lot of the stereotype, you know, that, mm-hmm. that we have. And we have a lot of richness here.
Oh yeah, and well, and that's part and parcel of the road show too. Is for folks who can't come to Appalachia, you know, taking Appalachia to them.
Right. Uh huh. And Judy did a fantastic job, you know, just telling what all the CRMW is up to. You know, it's really a busy place.
Well, what an amazing story of growth and stick-to-itiveness and persistence Coal River Mountain Watch itself is.
I know. When I first started with it, it was just so small and everything, and it just seemed like overnight it just bloomed, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody wants, you know, to talk to somebody from CRMW. And it's really good because without it, the people outside this area would not know what's happening here.
No, and frankly, that's the goal and the desire of the Masseys and Peabodys and Arches and whatever so forth that's out there. They would prefer that what they're doing go, you know,
a dirty little secret.
Well, yeah, and that it go on under cover of darkness because you know they're that kind of organizations. They can't thrive in sunlight. They can't thrive in the full view of human beings. The memo that came out from Don Blankenship saying that that the company wasn't responsible for minor safety. My God in heaven, to say that on the heels of Sago and Alma, what kind of monster is he?
Bob, you know, I've done a lot of thinking about that man. He doesn't have a soul. And I don't think that he realizes how awful it sounds and how it just chills people, and it makes the hackles raise on the back of their neck when they hear him make some kind of comment like that.
Well, see, for my part, I got to hope that he does have a soul. And this is my ugly little mean streak, Nanette.
I know what you're going to say.
I want him to have a soul so that it can be played with like Plato in hell.
Oh, I think it's going to melt.
And then be reconstituted. I mean, there's no good end that can come to that man who does that much evil on planet Earth.
I know that.
And by the way, what happened? He was supposed to retire this past December, wasn't he?
That's what I thought, but you know, it just like stink just hangs around forever.
It doesn't it?
Yeah. So. Maybe I shouldn't have said that.
No, that's okay. I just have to be careful not to get myself in trouble because the follow-up is what would...
It's not your fault I said it. You know, they come knock on my door. Oh, goodness. But, yeah, he just seems like he's just like a bad... I don't know.
And what blows my mind is that he's snidely Whiplash and Saddam Hussein all rolled together for us here in the hills. And mm-hmm. So many people outside West Virginia and Kentucky and Virginia have no idea who this freak is.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I had the sheer joy of watching him on the stand over to Boone County Courthouse during the Dustbusters trial, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That is the most conceited man. He just came right out and said right on the stand, I don't like to follow laws. I'm not going to follow laws. Right in front of the judge, the jury, everybody.
That's
he
amazing.
Has no, he doesn't think that he has to abide by anything other than what he wants to do.
Well, whatever his bloodlust and his greed drive him toward. You know, they're giving him front page coverage on the Wall Street Journal now, Nanette.
I know. Yeah.
I mean, it takes your breath away. The idea. Let's see, how many times can he stick his foot in his mouth? Because he approved all these things, even if some other subsidiary coal boss is the one who wrote the memo. It had to have holy writ stamped on it by Don Blankenship. Let's see. Hill people are OxyContin crunching junk, no good, worthless, lazy junkies.
You know who Charlie Pierce is, don't you, Bob?
No.
Charlie Pierce ran Elk Run Coal Company up there when they had all those dust problems.
I'll be doggone.
You didn't know that?
No, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, Charlie Pierce. Uh-huh.
Oh, a prince among men.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so you get that. Then you get the, we want to hire Mexicans.
No,
and I got nothing against Mexicans, but they're gonna. It's gonna. This 66 dead in Mexico. It's gonna. If that's allowed, it's gonna be repeated all over Appalachia.
Bob, I'm gonna tell you what. If they allow this to happen, you know these poor people don't speak English. They don't want them to be able to speak English.
No.
Who are they going to complain to? Who are they going to file complaints with over safety?
Well, that's
there'll be no one.
That's
if
the
they
whole...
get killed, if they're illegal immigrants and they get killed, it's not going to go on record.
No.
It's going to be shoved under the rug.
Right. They want to bring them here because it's okay if they die because they're, I mean, you want to talk about, you know, like I said, any Republican, any greedmonger's policies, if you scratch, you know, just a little below the surface, you're going to find a desire to work people for next to nothing, and you're going to find racism and bigotry.
Mm-hmm.
That's the unholy trinity all rolled into one on this issue. I watched a movie over the weekend, Nanette. You're familiar with Mate One, right?
Oh, yeah.
Well, John Sayles, who made that film, made an excellent movie a couple of years ago called Silver City.
Hmm.
And in that, I couldn't help thinking about this issue with the importing minors to Appalachia, because that issue deals very, very strongly and very artistically and passionately with what happens. You know, I hate it. I've gotten to where I absolutely go just sprayed roach crazy every time I hear some Republican talking about the threat from illegal immigrants. You know, it just makes me nuts because they're the reason that they want to come here. You know, if it wasn't for the cheap labor that the big money was out there trying to find instead of paying Americans decent wages, we wouldn't have that problem.
Well, the first thing that popped in my head whenever I heard that they wanted to bring him in here, and I know maybe it's a conspiracy in my mind, I don't know, but they bring them in here. They're successful in bringing them in here. Okay, they're paying minors good wages. There's not going to be any good wages left.
Well, no, that's the no. There's no conspiracy theory in that at all.
They're going to, anybody that has an argument, anybody that, you know, they're just going to replace them with the immigrants. They're going to pay them next to nothing, and all of our folks is going to be out of work and no place to go because we don't have a diverse economy here.
Well,
we have nothing here.
Right, and that's the whole thing. That's why I keep saying nothing's changed. Everything old is new again. Jeff Biggers touched on it in the interview. You know, 100 years ago, 125 years ago, what they call them, bohos and hunkies and, people from Eastern Europe, people from Southern Europe, African Americans that were brought in specifically to keep Appalachian miners from standing on their own hind legs and demanding to be treated as human beings.
Well, I'm going to tell you a little story that my dad lived through. He worked at Nellis for Armco.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they had a community in Nellis. It was a beautiful little community. However, it was a segregated community. They kept the people like us, you know, they've been here since, gosh, the dawn of people coming in here,
right.
1700s. They had them in one place. They had the Hungarians and Italians and all these folks segregated, clear in another part. They had the blacks in a place they called Bricktown.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't allowed to associate with one another.
Oh, no.
That was during my dad's lifetime.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, during my grandfather's time, if two or more people were seen together, that was considered organizing, and it was cause to throw you out on your ear.
Well, it even went further than that. Dad witnessed this when he was a little boy. If three women were on the rut on the street, or rut, we don't call them streets here, you know, that was just on the road.
Right.
The thug would come up with a billy club and beat them. Three women could not gather together and talk.
And yeah, and we're headed down that road again. And all these people who said, you know, I don't need no union, you know, that went to work for Massey.
Uh huh.
Well, they didn't for a while because that was part of Massey's game. They were going to pay you better than union wages.
Bob, you can't make them understand that.
Well, they're going to understand it when Javier and Jose come into the mines and they look at them and they say, look, you know, we're going to pay these guys $8 an hour. We'll pay you $8 an hour, too.
Mm-hmm.
Then they'll understand that, yeah, they kind of did need a union.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, I mean, I used to sit at Dad's knee and listen to him tell these stories of back when he was a boy. When Granddad was a boy, Granddad fought in the Battle of Blair Mountain. He mm-hmm. was there.
Yeah.
And, you know, you sit and you listen to all of the history, and then you look at what's happening today. The coal barons are wanting to take us right back to that era.
It's been their dream ever since working people got to stand up. They have said, and they have taught their sons and their grandsons through the generations, that someday the opportunity will come and we will crush all this and we will put the peons back where they belong.
Yeah. You know, back years ago, now my granddad shod ponies for the mines. He was a blacksmith.
Mm-hmm.
But back then, if a man got killed on the job in the mines, they didn't bring his body out to the end of the shift. They put him over in a god pile on a rib and left him lay there till the shift ended.
Day's coming back.
Well, yeah, look what they did at Sago. They left him men in there till 10 o'clock the next morning.
Well, sure they did. And, well, was it at Alma where they had to threaten the company with arrest before the law enforcement officials could get in?
No. That was right down the road from me.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that was the two guys the guy that was killed up here at Black Castle. That was just right down the road from me. And Archie Hubbard, the guy from our local fire department up here, was talking about, said, that's not the first episode they've had with them.
No, and they don't want rescuers on the property.
And that was about 3 miles from me where that happened, Bob.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Well,
absolutely. They would not let.
I don't know. You're there, Nanette. Is there a sense of the fact that there's a wake up call going out now?
Yeah, people are pretty well ticked off. They're ticked off. They're aggravated, and they're just saying, you know, what's going on? This is not right.
But can they stay mad, Nanette?
That's the problem. I don't know whether they have the staying power for it or not. I mean, there's a few of us that's old diehard, hard nosed people that don't forget. But to some of them, they're just, well, it's I'm going to the mall, or so-and-so's got a ball game, or distracted too easily.
Yeah, as long as Massey rents some state park and throws a party on the 4th of July with a big screen TV, they'll be all okay, and they bring in, yeah.
I tell you what, we get better reception, and more people listen that's out of this area, even though all this is going on all around everybody here.
Mm-hmm.
We get better reception from people that's away from this area. I don't know whether it's come on so slowly that...
It's because that's how it's always been, Nanette.
Yeah, but, I mean, they just kind of, it's ingrained in the people that's the way it is, and they don't want to change. They're afraid of change. Well, what will we do if the coal's not here? I think, honey, what are you going to do when it's gone?
Because, yeah. If you can reach out to people, Nanette, and explain to them that it's a heck of a lot more selfish to say, well, what are we going to do when the coal's not here? You know, what are you doing to your grandkids?
Right.
So you're saying that you don't feel like dealing with it. You'll pass it off on that little baby in the cradle.
You know, Bob, I live around a lot of coal miners, and a lot of them are fantastic people. My husband was a coal miner.
Right.
But you've got the young ones now that's not like the older ones. And as long as they can make a buck, and they can buy their four-wheeler, and they can go deer hunting, and they can have their good time, they don't care. They don't see down the road. They can't see past the nose on their face. And
I don't necessarily know that that's anything new, Nanette. I was bulletproof when I was 21.
Well, it's a dangerous thing.
Yeah.
It's a dangerous thing. And...
By the time the light goes on for them,
it's too late.
Yeah, they're done.
Mm-hmm, it's too late. And I've often thought, I mean, for the past 2 weeks, we've been watching an excavator on the side of the hill over here in front of our house beat the daylights out of the mountain. You know, mm-hmm. every day you feel the explosions in my house. It rattles the dishes in my dish drainer. You know, and you're living with this, and people all around here is like, well,
are you on public water, or do you have a well?
We're on public water, but I'll tell you what, one thing, we're fighting a We just put in a protest for a hearing on the underground injection of one of the abandoned mines up on Drawley Creek.
Mm-hmm.
And there's
now,
a lot.
Now, see, we got to be careful here, Nanette, because I know what you're talking about,
okay.
And you know what you're talking about. There's a lot of
okay, underground injection.
Yeah,
that's where they take the poisonous sludge. It's full of arsenic, cadmium, you name it. It's in this sludge. It's what they clean. It's the fines after they clean the coal, which is the toxic goo. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
They're going to take that and truck that to an abandoned mine. They're going to drill a shaft down into that mine, and they're going to pump this stuff down in those mines. Well, that eventually seeps down into the groundwater.
Water?
And that's what's poisoning the children down in Mingo County.
Oh, God.
And that's what they're wanting to do about 5 miles from my house. And there's a lot. I'm on West Virginia American Water.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of folks around here that can't get water lines up the hollers.
Right.
They're on well.
Sure.
And
they're going to get poisoned.
Well, you know what? We fought this Lakes Air East project across the way from me where they're doing all this destruction in front of my house. And we protested that permit, and my husband and I went and we copied every page of that permit. Did you ever see my permit?
Yeah, I have.
They're huge.
Yeah, it's like a Bible.
No, it's crates of those Bibles.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just good. And it's done that way for a reason.
Well, we went and copied every page of it, and we put it on our dining. We looked on the dining room table. We poured through this thing. Okay, we got down to where they did the water testing, Bob. They did water testing of people's wells over the telephone and said that they were okay. And they submitted that to the state DEP, and it was approved.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes. I've got the permit right here to prove it. I've got it right here.
They tested wells over the telephone.
Over the telephone, and they submitted it to the state, and the state...
What did they do, Nanette? Call and say, hey, how's your water taste?
Yeah, exactly, if they did that.
You got... You know,
I've got the name and address of the people they did it to. And the state...
Well, how do those people feel about it?
I don't know. You can't get them to come to a hearing to find out. But the thing of it is, Bob... We questioned them on that. We had a hearing. We questioned them on that. How can you test water over a telephone? And I looked at Haskell Boytech, which is the permit reader at the Logan DEP. I said, how do you approve this? Well, he wouldn't answer.
With a Ouija board.
Well, they don't answer your questions. You go there and they sit there and look at you like, duh. You know, and I'm saying... But they proved it. Stephanie Timmermeyer put her little signature right on that permit.
Well, you know, I mean, you know where Stephanie comes from, right?
Oh, yes. I know
Stephanie Timmermeyer, the head of our West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection, was a lawyer for the company that poured that, what was it, C8?
Yeah.
Poisoned
DuPont.
The groundwater of the entire Upper Ohio Valley?
DuPont. She was the lawyer for them trying to protect the company from liability. And that's who is over our West Virginia DEP. That's who's supposed to be protecting us.
God almighty.
It's almost as bad as Stephen Griles in the Bush administration.
Well, yeah, I mean, it used to be that when you got a Democrat administration in, that you got people on the working end of things.
Bob, the Democrat Party in this state is more Republican than Democrat.
Well, you're right. And that galls me. And there's,
I know, it does me too.
There's about eight generations of Kincaids and all kinds of other, you know, Goads and Gwynns and Davises and what, just spinning in their graves at the statement you just made.
Well, but, there's a bunch of Riggses and Douglases and Nelsons that are too, Bob.
Yeah, I know. I mean, with what's going on in the politics in our state, one of these days it's going to turn the whole geography over from all the, you know, from all of our ancestors spinning in their graves.
I know. I'm thinking about my poor dad, if he was still living. Now, he passed away in 96. He used to sit in the chair, he had a recliner, and he would listen to the news, and he would listen to these politicians, and he beat the arm of that chair with his fist. He was a diehard Democrat. I mean, tell you, he just absolutely, he said...
Yeah, a real one.
He was a real one. He's an FDR Democrat.
Yeah, we've got to draw that distinction now, Nanette,
yeah.
Because real Democrats are hard to find. You know, you've got these so-called... what's the world coming to when H. Wilbur Ross, Jr., you know, the financier behind International Coal Group that killed those men at Sago, that man is a registered Democrat, Nanette.
No, he's not. He's that's just wolf in sheep's clothing.
But you know, I mean, he goes to lunch with John Kerry.
Well,
no kidding.
that gags you. You know, Bob, I'm thinking they're all in the same bed.
Well, not all of them, but the trick is just like you and Paul going through those mounds and mounds of permit application, we have got to scrutinize the people that call themselves Democrats in this state and in this country.
Yeah.
I mean, if we're going to have a Republican administration in West Virginia, let's go ahead and have one. I mean, quit hiding. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Come on out. You know, don't show up at the ramp dinner and have beans and ramps while the Republicans are eating steak and tell me you're a Democrat when you're sitting there taking Don Blankenship's stinking money.
That's where we need our clean election bill.
Yeah. Yeah, we do need it. But, you know, we're up to our neck. I mean, I can name you, let's see, people that aren't in bed with Big Coal. Let's see, Bonnie Brown, Mike Caputo,
mm-hmm.
Carrie Webster,
mm-hmm.
And at that point I start reaching.
Yeah, absolutely, you do.
You know,
really do.
There's my representation. You know, maybe Tom Luisos over here in Fayette County. You know, there's my representation in the House.
It's scary.
I mean,
it
I'm painting
like,
with a...
You know, we have beat our head against the wall. You know, Judy just got back from D.C. I've been to D.C. Paul's been to D.C. You talk to the Congress people up there. You tell them the plot. You take the maps. You take the pictures. You know, and they just sit there with their mouth open. And you hope and pray that maybe they have enough heart to do something.
But again, what I said to Judy is so, so true, Nanette. It's finding the people from outside this region that'll help you. Mm-hmm. The Tennessee Valley Authority, where I was born and raised, that was not created by Tennessee senators or in Alabama senators or no. That was created by a maverick Republican back when being a Republican meant something, a maverick Republican from Nebraska, for God's sakes, named Norris.
Uh-huh.
You know, and Paul Wellstone reaching out to the widows of Jim Walker, of the Jim Walker mine in Alabama. That's, you know, that's where we've got to go. We can't go to Robert Byrd.
No, no, you can't.
We can't go to Jay Rockefeller. No.
You know, I will say this about Senator Byrd, though. At least we could get in the office and talk to his people.
Yeah.
Rockefeller wouldn't even let us in.
God.
It just
makes me crazy. So, you know, so you got to reach out to the real progressives, and first you got to find out who they are. You know, you've got to and then talk to them. And I frankly think you have more luck. Well, right now, as far as I can tell, I have very few heroes in the House of Representatives either. In the House of Representatives, Nanette, I would take 10 members of the Congressional Black Caucus for every, you know, for every lily white congressman in there.
Oh, I know.
You know, you reach out to the Kuciniches, you reach out to Stephanie Tubbs Jones.
Mm-hmm.
There are people who can be approached, but
yeah.
you know if you're dealing with some of the middle of the roaders, you're wasting your breath, you're wasting your time, and all they're doing is drawing their pay.
Yes, I know it. We need more Paul Wellstones.
Isn't that the truth? We got to roll on, Nanette. Thanks so much for the great conversation. It's always so good to hear from you.
Well, okay, we'll talk to you later then.
All right, say hi to him for me in the chat room, please.
I sure will.
All right, bye now.
Bye.
All right, quick break for the top of the hour, then we come back and more of your phone calls. 877, the number 4, head on is the number, 877-443-2366. I don't know about you, but I'm having a blast. I'm Bob Kincaid.
fight childhood asthma? Then fight it with a scrub brush and a hot soapy towel. Even in the neatest and tidiest homes, if there's so much as a crumb to eat or a drop to drink, household pests like bugs and mice will do all that they can to get it. Creepy crawlies like bugs and mice are unpleasant enough as it is, but they're more than just a nuisance for kids with asthma because they can actually trigger an asthma attack. So, give them a whole lot of nothing. Sweep up crumbs, wipe down tables, scrub dishes before they pile up in the sink, and store leftovers in plastic bags or bowls. Don't leave them so much as one tidbit or nibble, and you can stop a childhood asthma attack before it starts. Discover other simple ways to prevent an asthma attack. Call 1-866-NO-ATTACKS or visit noattacks.org, because no child should feel like a fish out of water. A public service message brought to you by the U.S. EPA, the Ad Council, and this station.
Treat me with understanding.
Treat me with respect.
Drug and alcohol addiction is an equal opportunity disease.
Treat me without judgment.
Individuals in recovery come from all walks of life and deserve to be treated with respect for winning one of the hardest battles there is.
Treat me with courtesy.
Treat me with humanity.
Alcohol and drug addiction deserves proper treatment. For drug and alcohol information and treatment referral, call 1-800-662-HELP.
Dad, can I ask you something?
Sure.
There's this girl I kind of like.
Say no more.
You just have to impress her. Okay, but how?
Just, I don't know, pick up a lot of heavy things around her.
Like what?
You know, desks, chairs, people. Grunt if you have to.
Grunt?
Yeah, be like, There you go.
You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. When you adopt a child from foster care, just being there makes all the difference. To learn more, call 1-888-200-4005. A public service announcement brought to you by Adopt U.S. Kids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
Hi, I'm Joanne Woodward. Ever notice how many things in life happen in a...
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
You guys are batting a million tonight. Now, I was a little nervous coming into the show. I knew we were going to have a wonderful conversation with Jeff Biggers. But I didn't know how much I was going to be capable of just because of the prep time that I was down all day today. But you guys have picked up the slack like you always do. You know, I don't like to confess being slack sometimes, but sometimes I am. Agnes, you've got your finger on the wrong button.
I know.
Okay, thank you. Let's go to Chris in Alabama. Hey, Chris, you're head on.
Hey, Bob.
What's going on, man?
A couple things. If your listeners now all over the world, God bless you folks, want to know a little bit more about Judy Bynes, they could go to my blog, themantlereport.blogspot.com, and go
say it,
down
say it,
the right side there.
Say it slowly,
April.
Chris. The Mansell Report, M-A-N-S-E-L.
Yeah.
Themantlereport.blogspot.com. Okay.
Yeah. And if they go down and click on April of 2005, they scroll down just a short bit, they will see my interview I did with Judy.
Okay.
And boy, I tell you, if you want to know something, you ask somebody that knows. It doesn't mind telling you.
Right.
99.99%. This is what it is. If you don't want to know, don't ask her.
Right.
Because
exactly.
Judy's going to tell you the truth.
Well, you know, it's part of that whole shooting straight kind of thing.
She's amazing. Another thing, I got a book in the mail today to review. It comes out next month. Congressman Jim Davis in Florida, you know, he's going to run against that Bush boy down there.
Yeah.
For governor.
Uh-huh.
Well, his brother is a trial lawyer, and he's written a thriller.
Oh.
An environmental legal thriller here. It's called Green 61, an Anderson Parker legal thriller. And his name is Cody Fowler Davis. And it'll be out next month, but I got it in the mail today to review.
Excellent.
Yeah, I saw that name and I went, Florida, I wonder. And I looked up there. Yeah, there it is. Looked it in the press kit. There it was. Something about West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
I was looking several blogs today, and one that I know you go to is the Tennessee Gorilla.
Yeah.
They had the state rankings for birth control.
Really?
West Virginia ranks 6th in service availability, 14th in laws and policies, 7th in public funding, and 10th overall.
That's not so bad.
That's not too bad at all.
I mean, it's not, you know, thank God it's not South Dakota. You know, as of last week, West Virginia once again gets to say, hey, wasn't us.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's whether it's some little kid like from last night, some poor little kid getting beaten to death with a claw hammer, or South Dakotans trying to the South Dakota legislature trying to get inside women's innards. Yeah. It ain't us. We get such a bad rap up here, Chris, and all we are is normal.
Well, West Virginia's teenage pregnancy rate has declined 21% between 1992 and 2000.
Let's see. Help me here. Who was president between 1992 and 2000? Yeah.
A bad guy.
Yeah. Bill Clinton. Well, you know, I mean, that's the kind of thing that happens when you focus on education.
Yeah. In West Virginia, 28,260 of the 372,890 women of childbearing age became pregnant each year. 74% of these pregnancies result in live births, and 10% result in abortions. The remainder end in miscarriage. So those are really good numbers.
Yeah, they are. And the thing is, you know, that's what I don't get about the right wingers, Chris, is that they don't, you know, and this goes to their hypocrisy, okay? It really does. It tells us exactly what's going on in their tiny little minds. They don't care about babies because you know what? If you want to end abortion once and for all you got to do is create a baby-friendly nation.
30% of women aged 15 to 44 in West Virginia are enrolled in Medicaid.
How many? What percent?
13.
Well, frankly, that's lower than I would have expected.
That's a lot lower than I would have expected.
Did you look at the Alabama numbers?
No, I have it. I'm going to...
Yeah, that's going to take a little medicine first.
I'm going to do that one later on.
You're not ready for the headache yet?
I take my heart medicine before I go to bed.
I got you.
And that's probably when I'm going to look. In West Virginia, $68 was spent on contraceptive services and supplies per woman in need, adjusted for the cost of health care in the state. $68. These are really, really real. I don't see why y'all aren't ranking higher.
Well, the fact of the matter is, let's not trumpet these numbers too loudly, Chris, because it'll get the morally bankrupt, ethically dead, righteously conservative pro-life movement all up in a twist. We haven't, like I said, so many of the weird things that I complain about going on in West Virginia or in the rest of the country don't happen in West Virginia because we don't have enough honest-to-God weirdo Republicans. You know what I mean?
Griping about that?
No, not at all. That's what I'm saying, kind of...
I got a bad connection.
No, just don't tell everybody. That'll get the weirdos stirred up.
Well, and they live. You can put on these glasses and you can tell which ones were the aliens,
Yeah, well, but the sad thing is everything that's good about those numbers, Chris, is going to change, and it's going to change for the worse because, dear leader, he didn't get to kill Social Security, but he's got Medicare and Medicaid right in the crosshairs, and he can't wait to put that down.
Yeah,
it's already happening.
He's got a brand new video out today, so maybe his record will be coming soon.
Oh.
But I'm going to get out of here and let you get your break.
All right, Chris, I appreciate it. You take it easy, all right?
Everybody take care.
All right.
All right.
Bye now. Our buddy Chris from the land of my birth. Awfully good to hear from him. Let's see, who's next? Rick's next in Panama City, Florida. Hey, Rick, you're head on.
Hey, Bob, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. You?
Oh, I'm hanging in. I got to go down either Thursday afternoon or Friday for the big squeeze, so we'll see how that goes.
Well, we'll be thinking about you, brother.
I appreciate it. Let me try to get this on a regular phone.
Okay.
Yeah, I was
listening. A thousand times better.
Yeah, I know it. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Anyway, the last caller was just great, Let's not forget that these Republicans are not pro-life.
No, hell no.
I mean, we are pro-life. Democrats are pro-life. These guys are pro-birth. I wish people could get that separated.
Yeah.
We believe that we become responsible for whom one tames, as in the book The Little Prince. And so, therefore, if you're going to let the baby live, then you owe the baby a decent place to live.
Sure.
To be warm at night, to be fed, to have education, to aspire to wherever that baby's water seeks its own level.
Well, exactly, Rick. It was a couple of years ago, right around Christmas time, we had a five-day-old little baby boy born to a woman who was, shall we say, challenged. And the gas company had already cut off the fuel to her home. She had no heat, and the baby froze to death.
Exactly.
And we've had a year, 2 years, whatever it is, of hand-wringing and hearings in front of our legislative committees asking Child Protective Services and the Department of Health and Human Resources what they did wrong.
And which brings me to your caller before this one.
Well, just one second. The one thing we didn't do, Rick, we never called the CEO of the gas company in front of any of those legislative committees, and we never called West Virginians for Life in front of that committee and said, "Where were you? You're so pro-life. Where were you?"
Exactly. And just what your other callers were talking about, when you thought you were doing a hometown show with the guy who wrote the book and then the lady that called afterwards, that's just a metaphor for Ohio, California, upstate New York, and other places in lower Florida. What they've done to jobs and wages and workers' rights, it's astounding how people would think.
Yeah.
That just making a decent living wage, there's something so horrendously wrong with that. And that was started by Reagan. We all know where it comes from.
Sure.
They started blistering the American worker and told the country that everyone who made good money was a fat, lazy slob trying to destroy America.
Yep.
And it started with the air traffic controllers, we know.
Sure. Well, you know, it's one of those fond little trivial facts that I love keeping in what's left of my brain, Rick. Do you know what the first official act of Ronald Reagan was when he took office?
No, I don't.
He signed a bill taxing waitresses' tips.
Well, what a big surprise. As he was busily having Chertoff and everybody else go down there and kill people in South America, with the likes of that creepy Marine, that son of a bitch.
Yep, no, it's okay, Agnes. You can say that.
That traitor. He's a traitor. Ollie North is a traitor.
Sure.
And he's celebrated as a hero. He broke the most incredible vow. I mean, this whole thing, that Marines stand for.
Yeah.
He broke that vow, and he has been heroically vilified, is what I want to say.
Yeah. And he's been lionized for his treason.
Exactly. And making money hand over fist while every good Marine dies in Iraq and everywhere else around the world.
Oh, and I know you don't listen to the right wing filth echo chamber. But you know that he has a standing gig coming on and talking about patriotism with Sean Hannity, don't you?
It just so happens I never miss a trick, and I listen to everything. I honestly do. I'll listen to all of that filth, Hannity, and everybody.
We're not just being flippant here, Rick. It is that. It is filth.
It is filth. It's lies. When the Marine Corps can be compromised, the Marine Corps, Semper Fi.
Yeah.
For Pete's sake, guys that are the ones that we actually send out there to do the job before the Army, before the Air Force, before everyone else, they go do it. And when they can be compromised by the likes of this, and this guy can be turned into a hero after what he did, he broke the code.
This is the whole thing where the general comes up and rips the epaulettes off your shoulder and pulls your sword and breaks it in two and makes you march out of the stockade stuff.
Exactly. And it didn't happen. And I can't for the life of me understand how the Marine Corps has been able to tolerate this kind of filth, unless they've just instituted these ringers that got into the Corps. That would let that happen. I don't understand how the rank and file.
Well, it is hard to understand, Rick, until you just kind of look up and apply Occam's razor to it and say it's all broken.
It's more like Damocles' sword, if you ask me.
Yeah, it's broken. Jack Murtha said, you know, it's almost broken beyond repair.
Yes.
And
sad. It is so sad how people can claim they love the life of a child, but they won't fund the formula that has to go to the child. They claim they love the troops, but they will turn around and make a villain, an absolute villain, a hero. They claim they love the freedom of the press, but yet all they celebrate are those that will lie to the American public. This is the most disgusting, putrid, horrific administration that has ever touched the face of this earth. And I guarantee you it'll take hundreds of years, if this nation survives, for anyone to be able to come next to this kind of vilification.
Well, and it'll take hundreds of years for anybody in the world to really feel like they can trust this nation again, Rick.
Isn't that the horrible truth?
Yeah, I mean, it's not just the Middle East. I mean,
it's everyone. I mean, for Pete's sakes, North Korea exists because they were right. If you want to deal with George, have nukes.
Yeah.
India, you want to deal with George, have nukes.
Yeah, and there, a great segue, Rick, you know, and him going to India. And it's just going to make more trouble. You know, he's going over there with a nuclear deal for India, for God's sake.
This man, George Bush, has run afoul from the time he was born. I don't know what this Poppy Bush did to him, but I can tell you this, whatever it was, he destroyed that child and he made a monster, and I hope he's proud of it.
Well, you know, I think mostly what Poppy did to him was ignore him. It's all the time that he spent with that white-haired old beast whose picture's on the Quaker Oats box, Barbara.
It's more than that. It's more than that. His own father betrayed him. He was shot down in, out in the Pacific.
Yeah.
And it just so happens he was the only person to be rescued from his plane and rescued from that island because his grandfather was working with the Nazis. Everyone knows it.
Yeah,
Prescott
sure.
Bush was working with the Nazis.
For God's sakes, Prescott started out. I mean, I guess we don't have time to go into the whole why should you hate the family Bush litany. But my God in heaven, Rick, Prescott Bush is a freaking grave robber.
He was everything, and he was instrumental in also hooking up IBM to be able to make the numerical processes that extradited the entire process of removing the Jews. But I can tell you this much. George Bush survived that crash because he had relations to the enemy.
Oh, I have no doubt.
I have studied this. I know it's true, and everybody can laugh if they want.
Nobody's laughing. Nobody's laughing anymore. All the business about, you know, the fact that he was a draft-dodging little child of privilege, and everybody, oh, you know, that's not true.
I'm not talking about him.
I'm talking about you. Yeah, you're talking about his daddy. Oh, there's filth in this family that runs, it runs up to the neck.
He got off that island because his parents had connections to the Nazis.
I don't doubt it in the least. Hey, Rick,
send you proof.
Okay, that's cool. We got to run on. I'm stacked up tonight.
Let me call.
Hey, we'll be thinking about you, brother.
Thank you, man.
All right, take care.
All right, bye.
Bye now. Our buddy Rick having some surgery done here soon. Keep him in your thoughts and your prayers. To our buddy Luke in Tennessee. Hey, Luke, you're head on.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
Well, I was telling Agnes when I first got on the line with her, I said, I haven't met your challenge this evening. I've got 4 out of 5.
Well, the fifth one is a booger. It's the one that nobody thinks of.
I know it probably is.
You want to take a shot at the first four? Okay.
Free speech.
Yeah.
Religion.
Yeah.
Press.
Right.
Assembly.
Right.
And the fifth one, I know it's probably something worded weird. You don't want to mean or something.
It is something worded weird. Petition for redress of grievances. Yeah, I know. but you're ahead of 99.9% of America, Luke.
Well, I tell you what, the thing gets me is maybe it's just the way they teach it now in school. When I was in high school, our last year, your senior year, you had to take in Tennessee, you had to take a half year of Tennessee history and a half year of American government.
Well, see, in Alabama, I got a semester of government and a semester of econ.
Okay.
Yeah. Same.
Well,
yeah.
Back then. And not too long before I got to that age, they discounted it, but you used to have a year of civics.
Well, when I went, it was ninth grade. Ninth grade was was Alabama history and civics, semester one and semester two.
Okay, let me get on to what I wanted to get onto tonight. I really got onto it. This weekend, the Sunday shows were hilarious. It was like the week before, you know, they had this thing come out with Media Matters. Where they were talking about if it's Sunday, it's conservative.
Right. 7,000 guests they analyzed over the course of, 10 years or so?
Well, the fun thing was this weekend was like, hey, we're going to prove him totally right. It's like,
yeah.
Russert comes on, has 3 Republicans. Okay. This week has their little roundtable discussion.
Yeah.
Let's see who they have on. They have Cokie Roberts.
Right.
George Will. Then what's the guy's name? Fareed
Zakaria.
Zakaria. And then just for balance, they bring in Tori Clark.
I'm sitting there going, where
is somebody? I mean, you know.
Yeah, she was out flacking her book.
Oh, well, they also had E.J. Maybe I got one wrong. I may have because I know they had E.J. Dionne on there for part of it.
Right.
And I'm sitting there going, E.J. Dionne is a moderate.
No. He's a liberal. I mean, if you ask the professional media, he's a liberal. You know, he's almost got his Communist Party card.
But you know what I mean? I know those people that we know who actually have brain function would, of course, say, you know, the man's a moderate, you know, and that's okay. I mean, I have nothing wrong against a moderate.
No.
But it's 3-on-1, so what the fun, you know, is that going to be?
Yeah.
Then you turn over to Face the Nation. Okay, I just went to the 3 majors. I didn't even go to the Faux News, you know,
right.
We ain't even going to go there.
No.
Face the Nation, of course, so you have your guest on. Then who do you have on? You have Tom Friedman, the head apologist to me for the Bush administration.
Oh, yeah.
At least for their foreign policy. anytime they need something, they go to Tom Friedman. He's, oh, yes, you're doing the right thing. I mean, it's like, and then the week before then, if you didn't have that, well, you've got Elizabeth Buemiller, who, I mean, apparently took over the job when
Steno when, Sue got, yeah.
Well, yeah, when Steno Sue got hurt, got taken out, she's the one that was standing there waiting to take the job next. I mean, God.
Well, you know, Judy gave her the knee, you know, Judy Miller gave her the knee pads, so, you know.
Oh, the best line I've heard this past week or so was last week O'Reilly was doing Hollywood. Mm-hmm. So he'd have different people on. He had quite a few. I'll give him credit. He even had some liberals on.
Yeah, yeah.
So the last night of it was Friday. He had on Mike Farrell, who's a really good fellow to listen to, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Really good, bright liberal, you know what I mean? He thinks his argument's out.
Right.
But during it, O'Reilly says, I don't do personal attacks. Now, Monday night, here comes on Keith Olbermann, and he's sitting there doing his thing, and he goes, get over it. He goes, get over it, Bill. If it weren't for personal attacks, you'd be a mime.
Well, you know, Luke, I saw that petition that Bill O'Reilly started.
Oh, God.
Please bring back Phil Donahue.
Oh, anybody who hasn't seen it needs to go to Curse the Liars. It is hilarious.
But see, that's the thing. There's such a lesson for real, honest-to-God progressives and liberals to take from all of that. What
and,
Keith Olbermann's
done... take them out and slap them around. I mean, God.
Yeah, you pull them, you take them out, you bloody their nose, you send them running on their way, and they go cry. That, you know, there's no bravery there. We're talking about a bunch of punks.
But I tell you what, if anybody ever wants to, go to Crooks and Liars, and they've got an archive section, and it brings up, and you can put in a name for their site, and just put in Olbermann's name, and you can go back and just look at it. I mean, it's like 10 pages of it.
Yeah.
And I mean, you just go there, and they've got video clips, and I mean, you see things on there that, I mean, it's like, you wish you almost could, they could just all put it all together in one long show. You know,
we all know that I'm a fan of Mike Malloy and Randy Rhodes and stuff. You know, you talk about these Sunday TV shows. Can you imagine Randy or Mike being called into one of those round tables on this week, you know, this week or whatever? You know, or Tim Russert, poor dude would be crawling under the table within the first 5 minutes. You know, liberals are not allowed.
That's like I've said. I mean, the only one I ever have any hope of, and I can understand, I've listened to Randy and Mike both, and I understand where both of them are like, you know, we're over this. You know, we aren't going to appear on these shows any which way.
Yeah, right.
But I sometimes would hope, I hope one time that since Randy's in New York, that someday maybe Olbermann will invite her on.
Oh, that would be
he's over in New Jersey.
Yeah.
And she might do his show, you know what I mean?
Right.
His is one she would do. But I tell you what, the one that got to me, it started off my weekend. Ready to shoot the TV. I swear to God, I thought about going to get the gun.
I know. We got to do something about those rubber bricks.
I know. On Friday night, Chris Matthews, Tweety Bird.
Yes.
During the discussion on all this stuff, and Bush had made his saving grace and all this stuff on the porch, but he actually compared Bush to Atticus Finch.
No.
Yes.
Oh, tell me.
I wanted to reach through the TV screen.
And grab him by his scrawny, tweety little neck. Oh, my. No.
I heard that. That's like I say, I really, honest to God, wanted to go get the shotgun.
Well, you've hurt me, Luke. You've hurt me. I've got that on DVD. I watch it every couple of weeks just to give myself a little starch, you know, with that whole speech about sometimes you fight the fight, you know, you're going to lose because blah, 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 blah. See, now I'm going to hear Chris Matthews in the back of my head. It's like Winston Churchill. Who was it that came? Was it Ann Coulter that
Anthrax?
Came out and said that? Anthrax, who came out and said that you know, George W. Bush is Churchillian.
Oh God!
You know, I can't hear Winston Churchill audio anymore. Never in the course of human events. No, I can't do that anymore because I see that little monkey face now.
Well, do you remember, now this is probably about 6 months ago, or better, probably maybe a year, do you remember when they had the whole thing with FDR?
Oh, God.
And they were comparing him, and I think Olbermann was one of them that had, like, FDR's grandson on.
Yeah,
he said, it's like, you know, it makes his skin crawl.
They just ruin stuff for us, Luke.
You were talking to the fellow about North.
Yeah.
It's like, I really would have loved to see that gone to trial because they'd heard a word they haven't heard. Which is what happened during the whole Iran-Contra. It's called sedition.
Yeah.
I mean, when you try to create a government within a government.
Right. Well, and it's worth remembering that there is only one crime defined within the United States Constitution. treason.
But I mean, you explain this to people, and they look at you sort of like glazed over sometimes. It's like,
what? Yeah.
Yeah. This is what they did. Ghoul. I mean, the one that bugged me the worst was the other day was sitting there watching that ghoul Negroponte.
Oh, isn't he just awful?
I mean, Lord.
Everywhere he goes, there are death squads. I mean,
you heard that thing about over Baghdad. I mean, you know, they're talking, you know, now they have death squads over there. It's like, well, he's been through.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like he drops teeth behind him and they grow up. You know, it's like,
yeah,
like it's the old Ray Harryhausen things. He drops teeth on the ground and the skeletons pop up out of the ground.
That's him. That's him. Where he goes, death and misery is soon to follow.
It's one of those things. It's like sometimes you just,
It's like a satanic Mary had a little lamb.
Understand. But you know what I mean? It's the one of the first things that Bush did when he got in, which told you that this was coming, was when he got in, and one of the first things I remember him doing was, oh, by the way, that release of documents from the Reagan administration, well, we have to stop that.
Yeah, right quick.
Because all that was just due to come in just as soon as he took office.
Yeah, an October surprise wouldn't have been so surprising anymore, would it?
Especially when you have all the paperwork showing, well, here's where we buried the bodies.
Well, yeah, and it's the same thing. What, 237, 208, 250, 287 pages of documents, emails from the vice president's office? Oh, we found them. You know, we spent $70 million investigating Hillary Clinton over a box of, a box of old... old publisher's clearinghouse entries from Travelgate. You know.
Well, the one that got to me was, I always to this day remember, I remember to this day when this happened, was I thought, you know, the one thing that I always remember was the night Vince Foster died, because I can tell you where Bill Clinton was to the inch. He was on Larry King, because he did a full hour-long interview with Larry King that night.
I'll be darned, I'd forgotten that.
Because he was on, and they were talking about stretching it into an hour and a half, and then had the guy come over and whisper in his ear, and it's like, we have to go.
Yeah.
And that's when they informed me they found Vince.
Well, but that sure didn't slow down Dan Burton from the
Watermelon Man.
Yeah, shooting watermelons in the backyard to prove that Hillary killed Vince. $70 million investigating that crap.
Well, you know how it is. The thing nowadays is we were sitting there talking at work today. We were talking about, you know, this thing about them having to put the cruise ships back in the business, you know, because down in Florida. I said, yeah, you got to hurry up. The people from Fox are sitting up there waiting to push people off.
Yeah.
You know how it is.
I do.
Because that's their main job now. Every time you turn around, it's one of these, like we say, it's missing white women syndrome.
Sure.
Oh.
You know, I'm surprised that we haven't completely forgotten that anything's going on in Washington between Darren McGavin, Dennis Weaver, and Don Knotts passing on, God rest their souls.
Oh,
Don Knotts, that hurt.
I know, and the thing of it is in fact, well, pretty much all three of them, you know, I mean, you knew they were getting it up in age, but you hadn't heard anything specific, you know, about anybody being sick.
Right, so, you're not ready for it.
Yeah, that was the thing. It was just sort of such a surprise.
Yeah.
But I told Agnes about the thing about midnight for that. Oh, have you seen this new thing now? This videotape of Bush at the FEMA thing day before Katrina hit.
No.
When
I must be way out of the loop right now, Luke.
This just happened this evening. Apparently now it comes out on Tweety's show like about 10 minutes to go in it. It's the lead story on Oberman. It's like a video conference call, and they've got the whole thing where he's talking to the people in the state and the local the day before Katrina hits. So when he sits there and says no one had any idea, the lie detector should blow itself up.
Yeah, well, yeah, and nobody, yeah, and he had no idea that Dubai Ports World, yeah,
oh.
I know. It just goes on and on and on, and then we know he's lying. It's his job. It's what he does.
Well, you know how it is. It's one of those things. Just like I say,
But again, you've got you make the point. You know, he's on there. He's on the videotape. He's lying. Can we have the impeachment now?
No, because you know what's going to happen. They're just going to sit there and go, no, he didn't say that. I mean, that's the one thing you got to give them credit for. They got more gall than anybody I've ever seen.
Oh, yeah, and then
you sit there and it's like, are you going to believe your lying eyes or what we tell you?
Yeah, right, and then the so-called liberal media says, you know, nothing to see here. These are not the droids you're looking for. And, you know, we're out of here.
And don't look at the man over there behind the curtain. Don't look at the man behind the curtain.
Hey, Luke, thanks so much, man. We're going to take our bottom of the hour break.
Bye.
Thanks for all the stuff you bring to the table, man.
Bye, Bob.
Later.
These are not the droids you're looking for. Oh, this is Head On. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Yes. Just wanted to let you know that Alistair Cook, okay, last year, right?
Yes.
He died of lung cancer that spread to his bones. He was 95 years old. Apparently, his bones have been or were stolen. Apparently, there's a ring of people out there that steal bones. They steal these bones and they make dental implants. Apparently, now he had cancer all in his bones, right? But the people who stole the bones rewrote the paperwork to make it look like he died of a heart attack. So now there's somebody else walking around out there with his diseased, cancerous bones in their body.
That is freaky.
Yeah, I just thought it was so...
Oh my God.
I thought it was so ghoulish.
It just freaks me out. Anyway.
Hey, don't forget to join Bruce and I Saturday, 10 p.m. Eastern Time for the next edition of Fourth Estate Radio. Get the streaming details at fourthestateradio.com. That's fourthestateradio.com.
It's Grace.
We're actually very boring people, Rama. That's why we call ourselves homebodies.
Well, it's Rama.
Me, sure. I mean, yeah, you know, group sex for us is when we're both involved.
That's a
It's really, really smart.
I worked the shoe
we're
leather
a nice
group.
Little Petri dish here in Vermont because you can experiment.
Join Grace and Rama, homebodies, every Sunday from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the web at homebodies.ramabahama.net.
Because liberals built America. Head On with Bob Kincaid.
This thing on? Yes, it is. I'm Bob, and you guys have made it a wonderful, wonderful event this evening. The dialogue that America so desperately needs. And, you know, we're doing our little part. So thank you. And thank you is coming from our pal Peter over at the Tom Hartman chat room. Writing, I just wanted to say thank you to Jeff Biggers and to all of the callers tonight. This is without a doubt one of your best shows, and the callers are incredibly interesting. That's why we talk about extraordinary Americans. The only ordinary, boring Americans are the people who just live on the work of other people. You know, the Bush family. They're dull. They're boring. And a note from our dear friend Sue in the UK, wishing everyone a happy St. David's Day, patron saint of Wales. And I've got a lovely little graphic here with leeks and daffodils. Beautiful. Gorgeous. And Sue, as soon as we've got some of the technical glitches fixed up and you can get back in touch, you got to teach me how to pronounce it in Welsh. Because I'm not even going to try. Because I'll butcher it, and I can't stand to do it. It's just so beautiful. And what Luke was mentioning a couple of minutes ago, I checked during the break, and there it was. Video Bush Chertoff warned before Katrina. This is the kind of stuff that just makes you want to go beat your head into a door until the little rivulets of blood run into your eyes. This is... I know, the little lurkers around the edges. And this is the part where he's going to talk about how we impeach Bill Clinton over sex. Yeah, it is. That's exactly what it is. $70 million of the people's money. $70 million Republicans spent.
Oh, we're careful with your money. We're conservatives.
$70 million that was spent chasing after Bill Clinton's zipper. And I have to sit here and read stories about the most negligent gang of heartless bastards that have ever inhabited American government. In dramatic and sometimes agonizing terms, this from the Associated Press, federal disaster officials warned President Bush and his Homeland Security chief before Hurricane Katrina struck that the storm could breach, listen, could breach levees, put lives at risk in New Orleans Superdome, and overwhelm rescuers, according to confidential video footage. And what I'm reading from here is, it comes from truthout.org. You can find it if you go to truthout.org. The video is there as well. Bush didn't ask a single question. Well, you know, why are we surprised? He never asked questions. He just tells people to do things, like when Richard Clark came in after 9/11 and said, Saudis did it. Some dudes from the United Arab Emirates were in on it. And George Bush couldn't even be bothered to ask, is that so? No, George Bush responds with a statement. Tie in Saddam. Go back, look some more. Well, sir, we've looked every... There's no relationship between Iraq and 9/11. Go find me one. So it should come as no surprise to read a statement like, Bush didn't ask a single question during the final briefing before Katrina struck on August 29th, but he assured soon-to-be-battered state officials, we're fully prepared. Well, hell yes, he was fully prepared. He had a box of Cheetos and a case of cheap tequila. He was, you know, a hurricane. We're ready for a hurricane party. I went to a hurricane party in New Orleans one time. Them hurricanes down there at that Pat O'Brien, they'll put you on your ass. I mean, that's the way this little punk thinks. The footage, along with 7 days of transcripts of briefings obtained by the Associated Press, show in excruciating detail that while federal officials anticipated the tragedy that unfolded in New Orleans and elsewhere along the Gulf Coast, they were fatally slow to realize they had not mustered enough resources to deal with the unprecedented disaster. And I am so damn sick and sorry that we've got these technical problems here right now, because I would give anything to be playing Kanye West right now going, George Bush don't care about black people, because he doesn't! And he doesn't care about poor whites either! George Bush cares about George Bush. It also turns out he cares about Jon Snow, who made a bundle selling CSX holdings to Dubai Ports World. And he's crazy about David Sanborn, who ran Dubai Ports World's Latin American and European operations and was promoted to Maritime Commissioner. It is now... Thanks, Luke, for bringing this up, because I wouldn't have gone and looked for it, and I got it in the email from our good buddy Gene, too, in Oregon. see, I don't want to stomp, I don't want to throw things, and you know, the babies are asleep, and I don't want to rout. Is Daddy losing his mind again? Yes, dear, Daddy's losing his mind again. They were told the levees would breach. Can't wait. Well, you know, our pal Rick a couple of minutes ago said that he does immerse himself in all the right-wing echo chamber filth and doesn't miss. And hey, you can tell Rick doesn't miss much. I guess I'm going to have to do something about listening to the right-wing echo chamber maybe tomorrow, too, because I want to hear. Do you remember the Glenn Becks and the Sean Hannity Jobs and the Flush Flemballs, the little oxymoron? All these creeps saying, well, my friends, it was clearly Kathleen Blanco's fault. And do you remember when Rush called the mayor of New Orleans Ray Nager?
Well, there were buses. There were herds of buses just sitting idle, not saving anyone. Those people stayed in the Superdome because they chose to stay in the Superdome.
It's the same tawdry, crappy, sorry, miserable argument that you get when you try to talk to some godless, soulless, motherless Republican about homeless people.
Well, I choose to be homeless. Right. They're so crazy, they like to live on the street.
It's the same thing. This is that. This
is a smoking gun. They looked George Bush in his beady little pig eyes, and they said, the levees are gonna go.
Hey, is it gonna be like that Led Zeppelin song I heard one time when I was drinking tequila and snorting cocaine down in Mexico?
Linked by secure video, Bush expressed a confidence on August 28th that starkly contrasted with the dire warnings his disaster chief and numerous federal and state and local officials provided during the 4 days before the storm. A top hurricane expert voiced grave concerns about the levees, and then Federal Emergency Management Agency Chief Michael Brown told the President and Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff that he feared there weren't enough disaster teams to help evacuees at the Superdome. Quote, I'm concerned about their ability to respond to a catastrophe within a catastrophe, but Brown told his bosses the afternoon before Katrina made landfall. Trent Duffy, presidential spokesman, said, I hope people don't draw conclusions from the president getting a single briefing. Okay, Trent, you jerk. We won't draw conclusions from the president getting a single briefing. We'll draw conclusions from all the damn briefings he's gotten. Jesus, Mary, and Joseph. August the 6th, 2001. Presidential daily briefing. Bin Laden determined to strike inside U.S. That's two. Can we judge him based on two briefings, for God's sakes? Nah. Three? How about three briefings? How about the briefing about how all the crap about the yellow cake uranium, you know, the one that said, the ones to George Bush that said, turns out the Germans have told us about old Curveball, and that last they heard of him, he was under that bridge over the Euphrates River drinking the screw top wine with his buddies. He crazy, brother.
Can we judge him on that briefing, Trent Duffy? When can we judge George W. Bush? When? When, you good-for-nothing, murder-enabling, right-wing Bush voters, when can we judge this man?
When? I had to listen to 8 long, filthy, perverted years of judgment on Bill Clinton. Over and over again, even though polls were taken and the American people were begging the Republican Party to just get on with it. Life is good. Leave it alone. Drop it, you morons. But they wouldn't do that because they won't do the will of the American people.
The will of the American people was that the people of the Gulf Coast of this nation be protected as Katrina moved inland.
But the people in the Ninth Ward, well, they were, I don't know, is it racial? Is it that they weren't white enough, or were they just not wealthy enough? Because after all, you got to remember, was it Trent Lott lost his house? Or was it Haley Barbour, some pasty-faced, doughy, white dude in Mississippi, and George Bush was there in a matter of days? Yeah, well, I can't wait to come back and sit on your porch after your house has been rebuilt. Screw you, George! Because you don't give a damn about sitting on anybody's porch in the Ninth Ward, baby. Doggone you, Luke. See, I don't have enough time.
No, that was
I'm playing. I appreciate the heads up. Then there's Homeland Security spokesman Russ Nock. Obi-Wan Nock. There's nothing new or insightful on these tapes. That's right. There's nothing new or insightful on these tapes. These are not the tapes we're looking for. Thank you, Obi-Wan Nock. Oh, my God. Yeah, there's nothing new on these tapes. In fact, they're not even tapes. It's a mass hallucination. Will you liberal media people quit dropping acid and talking about George Bush? Look at you hallucinating the fact that he was being told that the levees were going to breach and did nothing about it. Well, he did do something about it. He went off and played his guitar, got him a new guitar, and cut birthday cake with John McCain in Arizona and went to San Diego and played golf. Hell yeah, he did something during Katrina. He had the same damn fine high old time he's been having since he's been president.
I'll wait for that.
Gonna have to get a handy wipe and get the spit off the microphone. And poor Michael Brown. Yeah, you heard it here first. Poor Michael Brown. If this guy is actually on tape saying, I'm concerned about their ability to respond to a catastrophe within a catastrophe, turns out we might have prematurely crucified Brownie. I mean, he did have the... But if you're Brownie and you're in that position, what do you do?
Talk about what you're going to eat.
Yeah, and then they say, well, you know, Brownie, it's time for you to go to New Orleans. No! Oh, Lord, let this cup pass from me! But no, you can't completely forgive Brownie because he did go down there and he's shooting back the emails talking about, I am a fashion god. I read that email. Well, it... No, it said, well, I showed that email to Agnes, and it set off her gaydar.
But I like the gay.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I am a fashion god.
I just don't like Brownie.
Okay, now we've got to roll our shirt sleeves up. You know, Brownie is culpable. But Brownie is culpable, like, I don't know, I'm not going to use the Nazi reference. Brownie is culpable the way the horse that the dude was riding that, the guy who shot Stonewall Jackson at Chancellorsville was culpable.
That's what he did. He was a horseman.
Oh, yeah, I know. That's why I was reaching for the horse reference. But it's there. You can go to Truth Out. Have a look there. That's the. That's the quote for the ages. I hope people don't draw conclusions from the president getting a single briefing. He received multiple briefings from multiple officials, and he was completely engaged at all times.
Engaged to what?
Yeah, engaged to what? I know, Agnes.
It's that pretzel thing all over.
Nah. No, that's a quote for the ages. I hope people don't draw conclusions from the president getting a single briefing. And then he goes on to say that he had multiple briefings, and he's still screwed up! He's still screwed up. New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin, a critic of the administration's Katrina response, had a different take after watching the footage Wednesday afternoon from an AP reporter's camera. He said, I have a kind of a sinking feeling in my gut right now. I was listening to what people were saying. They didn't know, so therefore it was an issue of a learning curve. You know, from this tape it looks like everybody was fully aware. And they were, because Katrina is become, in the national lexicon, another word for murder. Not depraved indifference. This is murder by lying in wait. This is first-degree murder. This is murder by skullduggery. This isn't negligent homicide. This was... Look, it is what it is. And what it was a way... This was Republican campaigning. Going to get them a nice white New Orleans that'll quit voting all that Democrat stuff. My God in heaven. We don't have time to go into the philosophy of it, but how you can look at something like this, how anybody could ever vote Republican again. But then again, you know, they said that after Herbert Hoover and FDR lifted the nation out of the Depression. And after FDR died, it wasn't 7 years and we had another Republican president. You know, United States of Amnesia? I don't know. So thanks, everybody. We had great conversation tonight. I had a blast. I hope you did as well. We're going to get these technical glitches lined out, and we'll be able to get back to our old wonderful style. Hey, maybe by tomorrow we'll be able to play this after everybody else has. Maybe set some music to it or something.
Yeah, blame your producer.
But, I didn't blame the producer. It's my fault. It's my fault. But anyway, the show tonight was produced by my lovely wife, Agnes. It was announced by Brian Reznor. Randy Kerbway is our engineer. The stream is maintained by our good friend Ben Birch at WhiteRoseSociety.org. He also archives this program as well as many, many others, and he is in a fundraising drive, so do the right thing. The show is brought to you every night, most importantly, brought to you every night by the West Virginia District Council of Carpenters and Millwrights. Truly, they are building, or perhaps rebuilding, the American dream. And always, 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 RMR, it's all for you.